You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Today on Flashpoints, labor rights legend Dolores Huerta takes on the white serial racist in Georgia to get out the vote there. Also, longtime human rights activist Isabel Garcia talks about the retrial of a Border Patrol agent who shot through the border fence and killed an innocent Mexican teen. Also, hotel workers in the streets of San Francisco fighting for a living wage, and a special report from the caravan in Mexico as Trump moves to call out the military. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead in Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. While we're trying to get Dolores Huerta, we want to share with you some information about programming upcoming next week around the election. Flashpoints will be heard at 3 o'clock in the afternoon instead of 5, so that we can make way for Democracy Now's 3 or 4 hour coverage starting at 4 o'clock Pacific time. So Flashpoints at 3, and then we will have special coverage through the night later on. The news folks will be picking up the coverage around the state, around the nation. Let's see, we have a little cart on that one, so let's play that right now. We almost have a little cart, and we're almost going to play that right now. Coming up later on in the broadcast, by the way, we'll be speaking with Isabel Garcia. Isabel Garcia is a noted human rights lawyer and activist with 40 years' experience in the borderlands. She's going to tell us about the shooting, killing of a teenager by a U.S. Border Patrol agent who's shooting across the border. And should we listen to the cart? Let's listen to the cart. Hi, this is Dennis Bernstein from the Flashpoint Show, heard every weekday here on KPFA at 5 p.m. I want to invite you to join KPFA and Pacifica Radio for a special Election Day Flashpoint Show. We'll be starting at 3 p.m. instead of 5, and we'll be co-hosted by award-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author Greg Palast. Flashpoints will open the door to KPFA's all-night election coverage. We'll be followed by Democracy Now! At 4 p.m., and then the KPFA News Department will cap off the night with complete election coverage from around the city and the state. So tune in to KPFA at 3 and keep it locked through the evening for a special election coverage on KPFA Pacifica. Thank you. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Miguel Gavila Molina, just about to make contact with Dolores Huerta. Miguel, Trump is calling out the troops. There are so many battles going on. The racists are trying to disenfranchise indigenous communities, communities of color. We have been reporting nonstop on the various battles. We had Bill Means on and others, Danny Sheehan, talking about the undermining of the indigenous vote in the home of Standing Rock in North Dakota, and throughout really a number of states where there are variations on a theme, and the theme is get rid of brown voters, get rid of the indigenous community. We've got to steal this election for the white race.
And it is something very troubling. But at the same time, Dennis, all that negativity, just the outrageous twisting of information, deception, deceit, and lies, the fact of the matter is, and this, these are facts, these are documented evidence and fact, you know, one is that the caravan is largely comprised of oppressed women and children, young people. It is literally getting smaller every day. And Mexico, to some degree, has offered asylum to some of the groups. And regardless of what the White House is saying, people should know, anybody with any sense of reality and truth who still embraces truth knows that the White House is habitually lying. Everything that comes out is twisted facts into lies. There is no smallpox or leprosy coming on the caravan. This is not a caravan with, you know, ISIS members mixing in the groups of brown people. This is not an invasion. This is refugees fleeing violence, death, and destruction that was caused by U.S. foreign policy. And it isn't a crisis. You know, the caravan is not a crisis. It's not even close to the U.S.-Mexican border. The president is using just this incident to create hysteria. The real crises, Dennis, include what? Affordable health care. You know, the deficit, the national deficit. Election interference. Racism, gun violence, homelessness. Those are the national crisis, not the caravan coming from Central America.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. That's Miguel Gavila Molina. And we are going to, I believe we've made contact with the legendary Dolores Huerta, a regular visitor to the show Flashpoints and this free speech radio network called Pacifica. Dolores Huerta, Miguel and I are delighted to have you here to join us via telephone. And just back from Georgia, where you're fighting to get out the vote and to prevent a really a serial white racist from undermining brown people's right to vote. You want to talk about why you went to Georgia?
Well, I was in Georgia. I had the good fortune of meeting with some of the great, great women over there and many of the other folks that are campaigning, going door-to-door for our great candidate for governor over there, Stacey Abrams. And it was just delightful to see that the excitement is there and how many people and so many different communities are out there fighting for her and walking doors, going door-to-door canvassing. So it was a wonderful, wonderful trip. And I had, by the way, before I went to Atlanta, Georgia, I had just come back from Florida, where I spent 2 days this week and another 2 days the week before campaigning for Andrew Gillum for the governor of the state of Florida. And before that, I was in Arizona campaigning for David Garcia, who, as we know, is running for governor of the state of Arizona. And also we have another great candidate, Christine Sinema, who is running for U.S. Senate in the state of Arizona.
So you have been busy.
Before that, I was in Chicago campaigning for Mr. Pritzker, J.B. Pritzker, who is running for the governor of Illinois.
Have you had your 89th birthday yet?
Pardon me?
Have you had your 89th birthday yet? Because I'm getting tired listening to all the different things that you've been involved with. But that race, you know, you just came back from Georgia, and I want to talk to you more about that race. Because on the one hand, in Georgia, black people died. They bled for the vote. And this, nothing could be clearer. You've got a Secretary of State who's trying to abuse his position to steal the election. This is a very big thing, isn't it?
It's horrible what they're doing over there. You know, they're doing everything that they can to keep people from voting. And I'm sure that you've all reported on the 53,000 voter registrations that they're refusing to honor. And, you know, they've done so many negative things there in the state of Georgia to keep African Americans specifically from voting. And this guy Kemp, you know, the guy who's currently Secretary of State, is the one that's making all of these decisions. And, you know, you have a similar situation in the state of Illinois. I don't know if you've heard about that one over there, where Kobach who was one of these really anti-immigrant racists who's been in the forefront of doing all of these anti-immigrant laws. He's actually running over there for governor. And what they did over there in this town called Dodge City, you know, very famous Dodge City, they don't have a polling place.
No, this is – I want to remind people who we're talking about. This is Chris Kobach, who was supposedly running the President's Commission on voter fraud. That collapsed in the middle. Kobach, though, he's a very interesting guy. This is like your Harvard, Oxford, Yale, whatever, who is a – he really is a white racist who – he is the one who wrote the law for Arizona. The draconian law. Now he's running for governor, as you say, in Kansas, and he purged the voting machines from Dodge City because it's not a friendly city. I mean, this is what you're talking about, right?
No, what he did there, actually, what they did is that there is no place to vote. They closed the voting, supposedly closed the voting site that they had in Dodge City because they said that it was inaccessible because there was construction around the voting site. And the thing is that Rachel Maddow of MSNBC sent a crew down there, and guess what? There was no construction around the voting site. And in the place which they claim was inaccessible, there are actually several events that are taking place this week, and one event is taking place the day after the election. So that is just an outright lie. Then what they did is they sent notices to the voters and gave them the wrong place to go vote. And then what they did more recently, they put a voting place that is way outside the city. And the thing is that there are 13,000 Latinos that live in that city. That's enough Latinos to swing a gubernatorial election, but they literally have a place that's almost inaccessible for them to vote.
Let's. I want to bring Miguel into the conversation, but I just I want to broaden it out and get your gut reaction on what we see now. There's, I guess, the caravan is about 3,000 people left in the caravan. You've got the President of the United States calling out already 7,000 troops. He's threatening 15,000. Yesterday, he said he was going to shoot people if they threw rocks. Could you respond to this and how you, you know, deal with that kind of policy and linguistics?
Well, I mean, this is so incredible. Actually, what he is doing, he's prompting, he's hoping that somehow some kid will throw a rock and maybe get killed. But the whole thing is this, that my understanding is that the troops that he is sending down there really can't use any kind of arms against anybody. They're actually prohibited by law to do this. But I know that he's hoping he can create an incident, because that's what this president thrives on. He thrives on chaos. He thrives on violence. He likes to incite violence. And I think this is like an invitation. He's hoping that somebody will throw a rock. He's hoping that somebody, and I hope I'm not going too far when I say this, but when he calls for violence and then these incidents happen, and then, yes, people do get killed. And we're hoping that that never happens. And it seems like he's hoping it will happen, but we hope that it doesn't. You know, we hope that common sense will prevail, that nobody throws a rock, that nobody gets killed, and what he wants to happen doesn't happen.
Dolores, this is Miguel. ¿Cómo está?
Miguelito, how are you?
Aquí como siempre, dándole voz. Dolores, I wanted to ask you, you were in Atlanta, Georgia, and there was a massive convergence of women. And even coalitions, I believe, of domestic workers came out there to support the effort. In eso, it just tells us that Latinos are everywhere. All the states that you mentioned earlier that you've been campaigning, there are large, substantial pockets of Latinos in those cities and in those areas. And we know, as of last year, over 1 million new Latino voters are coming into the mix. Have you seen the reaction from the Latino community in regards to the election and the mobilization for the election this coming Tuesday?
Well, yes. In the states that I've been traveling to, we do see an awful lot of excitement on the Latino community. And I want to say this too, Miguel, is that we want people out there to really thank the labor unions because they are putting themselves out there. When I was in Arizona, there was a large group of people from Unite Here that were there, and they came from all over. They came from New York City, and SCIU people were there. And everywhere you go, you have people from these labor unions, Service Employees International Union, the hotel workers. They're everywhere right now trying to get the vote out. And I think we just have to, you know, tip our hat to the labor unions. And, you know, every time that they want to bash labor, we just have to remind them that labor unions, not only are they the basis for our democracy and all of our blue states, but then they send their troops to all the red states to also try to help get people to vote.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We have the absolute honor of speaking with labor rights legend Dolores Huerta, who now, besides having co-founded the United Farm Workers, now works with young women at the Dolores Huerta Foundation, working to find places to help support women. I guess you're pleased at the number of women candidates that are in and fighting now for election. I guess you've been very, very busy doing what you can at the foundation to support this new generation of young women who are running for office, right? This is big in what you're doing now.
Yeah, well, actually, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we organize in communities, so we have both men and women, and we're happy to report that several of our members that belong to the Dolores Huerta Foundation's Vecinos Unidos, or United Neighbors, are actually running for different positions. Some of them are running for school boards, city councils, they're running for utility boards, recreation districts. We've had a large number of them that have gotten elected in the past, and we have a whole new group of them that are running for office right now. And our foundation, we're part of another organization called California Calls. This is a group that starts in San Diego all the way up to the Bay Area to San Francisco in the coast. And we have right now our groups are all working together. We're nonprofit organizations plus labor unions, and we are working very hard. In our organization, the Dolores Huerta Foundation, we have had like 40 people making canvassing, going door to door, and making phone calls for several months now, not just before the election, but they do it every single, about three or four times a year we go out there to tell voters about the issues. And, of course, right now we're hitting it very hard. And our groups that work with California Calls, which, as I mentioned before, all over the state of California, they are right now knocking on doors and phone banking to remind the voters to vote. And by the way, I do want to mention a couple of important measures on the ballot. And one of them is, of course, Proposition 10. And we hope that everybody that's listening will call their friends and neighbors and tell them to please vote yes on Proposition 10, because this proposition will allow municipalities, counties, and cities to pass rent control. And we know how desperately people need affordable housing, and especially up there in the Bay Area, where you have so much of the housing that is becoming gentrified. So this is a really important measure, and we know that there's a lot of money from the realtors. They're dumping in millions of dollars right now to defeat Proposition 10. So we just want to ask everybody, please get out there and please, please vote yes on Proposition 10.
Before we let you go, people are saying that this election, 218, not even a presidential election, could be one of the most significant elections in modern time. Do you feel that urgency?
Oh, my God, yes. Yes, we know, because we know what happens now. And this election is going to lay the groundwork for 2020 when we have the next presidential election. And we have so much that is really counting on this. We have the census coming up in 2020. And we have all of next year to prepare for the census. But we know that depending on who gets elected, that will also have a big impact on what's happening on the census. And as you know, they've got a question on the census now that this is what Trump wants. They want to put a question on the census so that people will have to mark whether they are U.S. citizens or not. And we know we have a lot of mixed families, and some people are not going to want to answer that question, so that means that they won't fill out the questionnaire for the census. And what the impact of that is going to be very costly, because every person that does not every person that is not counted in our communities, that community will lose close to $15,000 per person. $15,000 per person that community will lose if people are not counted. And not only then does that impact on the resources that we get for our communities, but it also impacts on the district lines that are going to be drawn, because the representation that we get in Sacramento at the legislature, the representation that we get in Congress depends on how many people live in a district. And if they're not counted, it's like if they were not there. And that means that that community loses representation at the state level and in the state legislature and also in the U.S. Congress.
All right. Well, we really appreciate, Dolores Huerta, you taking the time out to be with us on Flashpoints on KPFA and Pacifica. We have been friends with Dolores Huerta and the United Farm Workers and the work you're doing now for as long as I can remember.
Excuse me. Yeah, not United Farm Workers. I'm with the Dolores Huerta Foundation. I left the Farm Workers Union in 2002.
Right,
so
no,
I
no.
I have my own organization, Dolores Huerta Foundation.
Just one of the many things that you've done in your life.
But we'd like to let people know where they can contact our group. It's
please.
DoloresHuerta.org.
DoloresHuerta.org.
Yeah, and please want to urge everybody, if you haven't done so, get out there, knock on the doors. If you want to come down to the Valley, come down to Bakersfield and Fresno and Madera. Come down to the Valley. Help us get some of our Democrats elected down here, okay?
Beautiful. Thank you for joining us on Flashpoints.
Oh, I thank you very much.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Molina. We're going to take it to Tucson, Arizona, where we're going to be joined by Isabel Garcia. She's a human rights attorney, and she's going to tell us about the fight for justice for Jose Antonio, who was gunned down by a border guard person in 2012, just shot dead across the border. We're talking about Lonnie Schwartz. His trial, I think he's being retried now, reopened last week. We want to talk about this in the context of the troops at the border. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Let me tell you about Isabel Garcia. She's a lawyer and an activist with more than 40 years' experience in the borderlands. She is currently a member of the Coalition Derechos Humanos and part of the Justice for Jose Antonio Coalition. She does join us from Tucson, Arizona. Isabel Garcia, it's been a very long time since we have spoken. We wish it was on better terms. I very much want to ask you about the trial, but just I want to get your gut responses, somebody who's lived in borderland, who's watched all kinds of incarnations over so many years, your response to Trump and his insanity with threatening 7,000 to 15,000 troops to the border. He's talking about special helicopter companies, medical support teams. It's unbelievable.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dennis. You know, I think I have two very polarized reactions. You know, obviously, this is an outrage. If people aren't outraged at the prospect of our men and women in uniform being used to come and confront poverty, confront women and children, it's dangerous, it's explosive, it's racist. But I have another reaction, too, which is, I told you so. I told you so. We've been telling you so. And people don't pay attention. The very first, the second statement from the defense attorney of Lonnie Schwartz was something to the effect, remember, the Border Patrol Agency is a paramilitary group. You know how long we have been demonized for talking about the militarization of the border, that we were allowing militarization in the hands of civil law enforcement. Border Patrol, ICE, they're civil law enforcement. We have Posse Comitatus, which really distinguishes us, but, you know, it's sure becoming meaningless, which prevents from armed guards, from, you know, armed forces from enforcing civilian law. Let's face it, what we're seeing here with the killing of Lonnie Schwartz, the killing of you know, 90, 100 since 2000, we don't get any justice here. I've been to many a trial in these four decades, hoping and praying for justice, keeping our mouth shut at times because the judge just threatened me the other day and said, you guys better not cause a mistrial. Imagine that. I was personally taken to task by a judge. And here we are. We're living in a land where we have absolutely no justice for any of the victims of Border Patrol brutality, whether it's Anastasio Hernandez, who was tasered to death and filmed in California, whether it's Guadalupe Guerrero's son, Carlos Lamadrid, a U.S. citizen that was shot in the back seven times by the Border Patrol, and on, I can give you millions and millions of these, not millions, I'm sorry, exaggerating, dozens of these accounts. Just look up the list of SBCC, the Southern Borders Communities Coalition. They have a listing of all of the people murdered. The Arizona Republic has a listing of all of those murdered in the state of Arizona. And so here we are in the second week of trial for Lonnie Schwartz, and having seen part of the trial, having heard the opening statements by both Lonnie Schwartz's attorney and our side, it's very clear to me we're not going to get justice. You know, it's, I pray that I'm wrong, but when have we ever gotten justice for anybody killed along this border?
That is that's a very good question. Can you lay out the details for people who are not familiar with the case? What are the basic details of the situation? How did this murder take place?
Let me tell you really quickly. On October the 10th in 2012, there was a report, about some bundles being of marijuana being tossed over the border, something really common for the Nogales Police Department. And so they all gathered in an area that I know along the wall. It's not even a dangerous place. The defense has made it to be like a war zone. And so Lonnie Schwartz came to assist along with two others. And so pretty soon Lonnie Schwartz on his own decides, he claims, because they were being pelted by rocks and none of the other agents felt any rocks. He claims that one of the dogs was hit by a rock, and his handler denies even knowing that. The other officer said they weren't in fear of her life. And guess what he did? He went to this wall. And if you're throwing rocks, you know, he's going to shoot reflexively. Of course, it's going to ricochet because you've got 4 inches between these metal rods. And that's what the wall is, right? He stuck his firearm through it and shot him in the back. He wasn't satisfied, so he came, stepped back, reloaded, went to another position a few feet down, shot him several times, reloaded, changed his position, and shot him again. And guess what the defense attorney says? Oh, my God, he feared for his life in that first shot. And he died in that first shot. And all the other shots, well, they don't matter because he was a dead body.
Oh, the other shots don't matter. I get it. He killed him on the first one, so it was just sort of a waste of bullets.
That's exactly what their defense is. And, of course, the defense involves a lot more. It involves trashing this child, 16-year-old boy. Now they're making him out to be a member of a cartel and that he was throwing rocks, and he was not throwing rocks. And if you saw the place, he was shot in Nogales Street, and across the street is a cliff that's about at least 30 feet, 20, a hill, and on top of that is this big metal wall. You'd have to be Superman to clear any of these rocks. And yet, you know, he acted like, oh, yeah, he was afraid for his life. That's what we see with the Border Patrol agents time and time again, acting aggressive and hostile and abusive on the scene all the time. And then when they get to court, it was like, oh, I was afraid for my life. And so now with this president indicating that, yeah, rocks are, you know, are weapons, to consider weapons, this is an outrage. It really is an outrage. And Jose Antonio Elena deserves justice. His family deserves justice. We as communities on the border who have seen so many of these killings with impunity. With impunity. I wish I could tell you it was different. That Michael Elmer was convicted. No. That Nicholas Corbett was convicted. No. And on and on. These guys aren't convicted. They're not convicted. They're even arguing that we shouldn't, they're not even entitled to any compensation because after all, he was killed on the Mexican side. That's how cynical and outrageous it is. That's on the civil side. We're still here facing the criminal trial of Lonnie Schwartz, and you know, we're prayerful, but we're not hopeful. The jury selection, the judge tried to exclude us from the jury selection. A jury with that's heavy with law enforcement background and experience. A jury that really is like the rest of the American public, let's face it, which doesn't understand the history of immigration and why we're here, nor do they understand that the Hondureños that are coming are a result of forced migration. These are not invaders. This is forced migration. Forced by who? By their own government. Who supports their government? It's propped up by the United States of America. That's who propped it up. And so here we are blaming the very victims of our U.S. policy that are coming north in order to just seek some safety. And we're treating them as invaders. Very explosive, very dangerous. And we at the border here, we have been living this for a long time, warning people over and over. We're militarizing this border, and we have gone overboard where, you know, civil governance is being handed over to our armed forces. And that's not a place for any of our armed forces, just like police departments have no place in civil governance and city departments, and our military has no place in governance, because that is the unique thing of this United States, is that civil government rules the military, not the other way around.
Isabel, this is Miguel Gavilan Molina. It's good to have you on with us. Pero I wanted to ask you the situation, because we have the border crisis, and then you have a militarized border patrol force. When Obama was president in his first term, I believe that the Border Patrol force was under like 40,000 people from, you know, from California all the way to Brownsville, Texas. In the administration of the Obama regime, we saw it increase to 200,000. You know, just like unbelievable increase in less than, you know, 6-7 years. And a lot of the personnel that's coming to the border to be, you know, Border Patrol police are coming back from the armed services. It's almost Absolutely. Like a job opportunity, you know, and Trump, you know, has really kind of promoted that job opportunity for our returning soldiers from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from Iran, from wherever, from the Middle East, excuse me, you know, coming back here and having employment. These are trained, you know, officials that have been our soldiers. And when they see brown people, they're not distinguishing. So let me ask you, because there is a mentality, you know, on this militarized border. That we also see in large cities where there's large communities of color, a militarized police that almost feel like they're warrior cops, you know, who have the same defense. Oh, I felt my life was threatened. I thought I was going to die. That's all they have to say. And
just
how many?
We don't get, justice for African Americans that are killed. We don't get justice for our people being killed along this border either.
No, so how do we go about changing the whole militarization of the border, of Border Patrol, and even that argument that I said, you know, where they use, be it Border Patrol officials or city police, municipalities, you know, I felt I was going to die, I felt my life was threatened, and then they have a license to kill. We haven't seen any real convictions on that. We rarely see a convicted police officer. You know, I think last year there was one, you know, in 2017, 2018, they was convicted. Right. But there are hundreds and thousands of killings, and there's no mechanisms, because the judges, the juries, you know, the biggest budgets go to the police, the biggest budgets go to the Border Patrol. So how can we change that culture? What do you see?
Well, I think it's very clear that since 9/11, the entire society has given in to this fear. It's all fear.
Yes.
If you push fear, you know, that's it. Fear sells. You know, we talk over and over about funding. If you want to stop crime, you fund the front end, the social justice end. There's schools, there's medical care, there's jobs, there's employment. There's a healthy society. That's what defeats crime. And they don't want that. They don't want that because mass incarceration has served its purpose for its our society. Let's face it.
It's an industry.
We went from slavery, post-slavery, to mass incarceration. And then now that the people started waking up, hey, we're spending more on mass incarceration than education. What's wrong with that, teacher? Well, they said, oh, good. Now our next pool of people, hey, you know, we've got a big pool of people for many, many decades, and that's immigrants. Immigrants are the international criminal now. When it's the journey of the poor, what are we going to do, shoot at poverty? Instead of bringing a wall of justice, a wall of warmth, a wall of food that would cost a fraction of just what we've mobilized in the last few days of armed forces. Imagine that. So we as a society have to stop giving in to this fear and allowing our cops and military to control everything. The police are trying to control cities across this country. They're taking political ads. The Border Patrol agent here, he's a vice president. In Tucson, he's a vice president. He's on political ads. What's wrong with us? It's wrong with us. And that's because a lot of immigrant rights groups and the Democrats, and I'm part of them, but back in 2007, they went along with the militarization as part of the immigration, comprehensive immigration. They stole comprehensive immigration, a phrase from us, which from us it meant let's deal with the root cause. Why are people coming? That's comprehensive, not militarizing our border, not causing havoc in other countries, and then expecting them not to come into our country and, what, putting an electrified fence? I heard people who said, yeah, let's put alligators. I mean, just the discourse is going to take, I think, years and years to recover from, I'm sorry to say.
Well, let me jump in here because we're running out of time. Just before we say goodbye, and we appreciate the time, Isabel Garcia, and we want to check back with you. How is the family doing of Jose Antonio? Are they getting support? How are they doing? Because this was a horrible killing.
You can imagine how they feel when the federal prosecutor who's representing them did not object when they called their son a cartel member. I mean, that's really tough. And, you know, you have to understand, this is the left arm prosecuting the right arm, because it's the U.S. government that generally works with these same very Border Patrol agents here in Tucson. That's all their bread and butter. That's where they get all their cases. And so then this other department is now prosecuting them. So, you know, and I'm not saying that they're in collusion. I'm just saying that these individuals really don't understand the political nature of these cases. Many times they try them as if it was a white teenager being killed. Well, sorry, that doesn't work the same. And when they don't understand these political implications that immigration debate has and all of it, well, that's what you get. You got a jury that was picked in half a day. Oh, my goodness. What kind of questioning did they go through that was picked in half a day? And on and on. I mean, we're in the middle of the trial. I pray that there would be justice. But, you know, it's really tough for me to see 12 people voting
to convict in this climate that is so racist and anti-immigrant.
All right. Well, we are sorry.
And we have to do something about it, Dennis. I'm not conceding. We will stand up and do something if we don't get justice. I'll tell you that much.
All right. Isabel Garcia, we thank you for taking the time out. We want to check back with you real soon and see how things are going down there in Tucson. We were down there many years ago to broadcast from your offices, and we're going to come back.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Right. We're in doing our Dia de los Muertos walk as we speak.
Oh, you're on the walk. Well,
yes, we have 3,062 crosses and 123 that we painted for this year. Add them up. And those are the people that have recovered remains in the state of Arizona since 2000. Imagine that. It's an outrage.
Those are the names that are on the crosses of the march. The people who died coming into the U.S.
Yes.
Who died that horrible death on the desert.
Horrific, horrific death. And these are only found remains because there's many, many that are never found. Our environment is very hostile, especially in the summer, and they're skeletalized and scattered through the desert. I kid you not, in 2 weeks.
Wow. All right. Well,
the more we build a wall, the more we disappear. The further out we go, the further out people have to go to try to walk. People used to immigrate through the little holes in the fence, right in Nogales. Nobody died. But when Clinton started the whole militarization of the border, and this, of course, supported by all the Republican administrations, look what we have. We have death.
You know,
policy that's based on death.
I have a personal memory in 1985 of going to a wedding in the church in Nogales, Mexico, and then coming through the fence to Nogales, Arizona for the reception with the family on both sides. That was because what do they say? My brother Miguel here says we didn't cross the border. The border crossed us. So you're in Mexico now, right? Thank you for being with us on Flashpoint.
Thank
we appreciate
you for
it.
Having us.
All right. Take care.
Okay. Good night.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're not going to give up yet either. We have managed to touch base with David Bacon, who knows a lot about the history and the policy behind this now latest culmination in 10,000, 15,000 people to the border to fight a caravan of 3,000 people who are 1,000 miles away. And we're talking about the troops and special helicopter groups and medical teams. And here we go. David Bacon, I want to talk to you about the strike that you've been covering in San Francisco, but I want to get your gut reaction. Wait, well, listen to this. Here's Donald Trump threatening to shoot people, threatening to shoot rock throwers yesterday. Let's listen to this.
Anybody throwing stones, rocks, like they did to Mexico and the Mexican military, Mexican police, where they badly hurt police and soldiers of Mexico, we will consider that a firearm. Because there's not much difference when you get hit in the face with a rock, which, as you know, it was very violent a few days ago, very, very violent. That break-in, it was a break-in of a country. They broke into Mexico.
They broke into Mexico. David, your response to the latest incarnations of U.S. immigration policy?
Well, you know, Dennis, I didn't get to listen to all that Isabel, a good friend, had to say to you, but I can imagine she might have mentioned that there was a young man who was shot and killed by U.S.
No, that's what we're talking about, because he's on trial now. So
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, in the first place, you know, Trump isn't the first person to have made this threat. And in fact, there are Border Patrol agents who have actually carried out this threat and have shot people. But the whole militarization of the border and calling soldiers down to the border again, you know, Trump has his own reasons for doing this, which are clearly, you know, that we have an election next Tuesday, which is the main reason why he's doing it.
Right.
But he's not the first. We have seen U.S. soldiers and National Guardsmen, you know, called down to the border before in these kind of nativist, hysterical kind of, you know, I don't even really want to call them reactions to things, because I don't actually think that they are reactions to anything that is going on in Mexico or caravans or anything else like this. I think these are political moves by U.S. politicians who conceived of these things as being something that's going to excite a nativist voting base and help them, you know, win elections. So the political opportunism of it, I think, is the most sickening part of this whole thing, because it is really putting people's lives in danger. It is inciting and fomenting hatred. It is creating this atmosphere in which we, you know, what we saw in Pittsburgh, what, you know, what the end result of this, you know, atmosphere is. It's an ongoing problem that we have in this country, you know, and Trump is the latest and ugliest manifestation of it, but it is a problem that we have had before, you know, and so this is sort of really, I guess, I would say, this is the task before us as people and before our movements, and that is that we have to get strong enough and well-organized enough that we can put an end to this, you know. I grew up in the 1950s. In the 1950s, Dennis, there was no wall. In fact, it was when Nixon was president that they put up the first barbed wire fence at Playas de Tijuana, which is the border section of the border that sort of goes down into the Pacific Ocean from the city of Tijuana, where they put up the first barrier. And that barrier was a barbed wire fence. And Pat Nixon, you know, Nixon's wife, came down to inaugurate it, and she made this speech in which she said, I hope that there will come a day when we will not have any borders between our countries. Can you believe it? This is a Republican wife of a Republican president. You know, it's hard to imagine, you know, such a thing now. And now, of course, if you go down to that same section of the border, what you see is this steel wall of these steel bars that are, what, 12, 15 feet high. And it's really a symbol. It's really a symbol because if we had free movement of people across the border, people would also be able to go back to Mexico. They would be able to go back to their countries of origin. One of the biggest tragedies and problems of people who come to this country in the last, you know, couple of decades, especially farm workers, especially indigenous people, is that leaving your family behind, if one of your relatives, your father, your mother, back at home in Oaxaca gets sick and is on their deathbed, you cannot go back and see them because you can't get back into the United States to your job afterwards. The cost is simply too high. So, you know, the creation of this kind of impassable border is something that causes enormous problems and enormous pain and family separation and tragedy for people. And part of it we see in the deaths that Isabel was talking about, the people who die trying to cross it. Part of it is in the separation of families. Part of it is in the price that people pay for that kind of separation. You know, I think about my own father, my own mother, and, you know, I slept on the floor of my mother's apartment house when she was about to die because I wanted to be there with her, you know, and I know that this is a normal human feeling, a normal human reaction. And so you create a border like this, and what happens is that you prevent people from doing these normal human things. You sort of create an inhuman life for people as a result of it. And, you know, the rationale for it is basically this kind of racist hysteria, really.
All right, we're running out of time, and I want to get your information. What you learned, what we know now. We know that the strike. Remind people about the strike in San Francisco. There have been solutions in Oakland and somewhere else, but bring us Detroit up to speed.
Well, there were settlements reached. In fact, I'm waiting in the office here in Oakland of Local 2850, which is about to take the ratification vote on their settlement here. But the strike is very much alive. in San Francisco. In fact, there was a big hearing at the Board of Supervisors that Marriott refused to attend, in which dozens and dozens of workers.
Who exactly is on strike?
Testimony.
Who, just remind people.
Six hotels.
Okay.
The Marriott Corporation is on strike and has been on strike in eight cities around the country. And in the Bay Area here, that's included San Jose, Oakland, and San Francisco. The City Center Hotel here in Oakland, the San Jose City Center Hotel in San Jose, and then there are six of the fanciest, swankiest hotels in San Francisco, which used to be independent, most of them, and which Marriott now owns. You know, the Sheraton Palace is no longer the Sheraton Palace. It's now the Marriott Palace. You know, the St. Francis Hotel belongs to Marriott. These are old hotels, and they are also, they're some of the fanciest hotels in the world. And they have been union hotels for a long, long time. And so Marriott has bought them out. And Marriott is now essentially refusing to agree to the basic things that workers are asking for in order to make their jobs livable, or as they say themselves, one job should be enough. In other words, that the pay for working in a hotel should be high enough so that workers don't have to take second and third jobs. In fact, that was the testimony of the Board of Supervisors today, was by workers talking about what their actual work lives and their home lives were like because of the fact that they can't support their families. One guy was saying, you know, my paycheck goes simply to pay rent. All the other expenses in my house I have to pay by having a second job. Other people in the family have to work. So this is just the kind of sacrifice that people make. And the other thing that's not in agreement is health care. And Local 2 in San Francisco, big hotels, Local 2 has had for many years something that they fought very hard to get, and that was health insurance that the employer pays for 100%. And now Marriott is refusing to agree to that. And we, of course, know that health care and health insurance is going through the roof. It's getting higher and higher and higher. And Marriott is just sort of sitting there silent at the table when the union says, well, we want you to continue this, and they sit there silent, the basic message there being that they don't agree, that they want the workers to pay for this. So those are some of the issues. There are some other ones out there, but those are the big ones. And so the workers in San Francisco, you know, there were hundreds. In fact, I would say that there were over 1,000 workers in the UN Plaza in San Francisco today, and inside and outside the Board of Supervisors chambers, telling the supervisors. And the supervisors in San Francisco are a pretty liberal lot. And a lot of them, well, Hillary Ronan, who was the supervisor that organized the hearing especially, she was very vocal in saying how offensive it was that Marriott refused to even come and talk to the Board of Supervisors, while at the same time Marriott Corporation and the hotel owners, they get a lot of financial breaks in San Francisco because the industry that they are part of, tourism, is so crucial to the city's economy.
All right. Well, that is an incredibly important story. And David Bacon, you always do an incredibly good job. Best way for people to read all your stuff, catch up on the records you're keeping in terms of both your photography and your incredibly good journalism. Best way to get all of it?
That is to Google my blog. And my blog is called The Reality Check. So if you Google David Bacon, The Reality Check, you'll get my blog, and the stories are up there, and the photos are there, and also on the Flickr page as well, too, that has a bunch of them up there as well.
Thank you so much for taking the time out. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dennis. Take care.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I'm Dennis Bernstein, and Miguel Gavilan Molina is here. It's the Day of the Dead.
It is the Day of the Dead, Dennis, and we have a special guest on the line with us, and that is Don Rafael Gonzalez. He is Berkeley's poet laureate and a contributor here to KPFA, to Flashpoints in La Onda, on this very significant sacred day for Latino indigenous peoples. It's a great privilege to have you with us, Don Rafael. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Muchas gracias, Don Miguel. Siempre es un placer estar con usted.
On this day, there's been a lot of activity, a lot of processions, altars being built throughout California and throughout the country. Day of the Dead has now spread beyond California, beyond the Southwest. It's everywhere where there's Latino, there's pockets of Latino communities in the country. But you know, as one thing that I've noticed, Don Rafa, in the last couple of days, I've attended a couple of functions, and I noticed that the festive spirit is sort of lacking. You know, the political climate that the people face right now have put people in a state of almost like fear or uncertainty. Nobody knows. Pero you yourself have been out there attending some of these gatherings. Have you sensed any of that?
Yes, there certainly is a more somber mood around, and I would say not just for the Days of the Dead, but generally yes. A somber mood pervades everything when we are under the aegis of racists and bigots and tyrants.
Absolutely. And Don Rafa, just to help our listeners, tell us a little bit about, you know, the significance of Day of the Dead. Particularly in these times?
The significance is, of course, the honoring of our dead. It's primarily a sad feast because it always the loss of death is a sorrowful thing. That cannot be avoided. In the Mexican tradition, as it has developed, there is a sense of humor and there is a sense of almost the ridiculing or a taunting of death that has developed in the last several centuries. So that colorfulness or that color is what has made the Día de los Muertos in Mexico such a unique holiday and is the basis for its great attraction to the community at large. Many of my friends who are not from the Mexican tradition have taken on and adopted the tradition for their own comfort in confronting death. And the color is, of course, one of the great attractions. But let's not lose sight that color and that humor and that frivolousness is an addendum, is something that is laid upon an essentially somber holiday. That somber quality is enhanced or deepened by the threats that surround it is unavoidable. We have to very much protect our joy and our celebration of life. Within the tradition of the dead in Mexico, there's also an underlying celebration of life. Yes, death is a tragic sense of life itself that cannot be avoided, but it is tragic precisely because life is so precious, so colorful, so joyful when it is fully lived.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Don Rafa. And unfortunately, we're going to have to cut it right here. We're running out of time, but that really puts it in context. We really appreciate you taking a few minutes with us, Don Rafa, to bring a sense of reality in with Day of the Dead and, of course, how we relate to it as living human beings. Thank you again, Don Rafa, for being with us. And Dennis, we're getting ready for the weekend.
Looking forward
to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Miguel. Thank you, Don Rafa. Thank you, Frank, for all your good work.
Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. And special thanks to Free Will and Frank Sterling for production. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at DennisJBernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, how the system creates mass murderers and the government's murderous experiments on U.S. citizens. It's all true, and it's in part three of the film Human Resources. I hope you'll stay tuned. Scott Noble's documentary film, Human Resources, is wide-ranging, to say the least. On New World Notes, we passed over the film's first part, which is on eugenics. We heard the next part on management's increasing control over workers. Then we heard the next part on the public schools. Here the film shows John Taylor Gatto, who argues that U.S. public schools were always designed mainly to produce those docile, obedient, powerless workers that the system needs to maximize corporate profits. Education had nothing to do with compulsory public schooling. Then the film moved on to the related issues of competition, frustration, violence, and scapegoating. A thread running through all these topics is scientific psychology, used by the elite to increase their control over the 99%, as we would now call ourselves. One school of psychology, behaviorism, has been particularly helpful to elite control. This week, the film continues its look at the behaviorist psychological concept, frustration aggression. The more frustrated the system makes you, the more likely you are to respond with aggression, usually aggression against the wrong target, against yourself or a handy scapegoat. The aggression seldom gets directed against your real enemy, the elite running the system, the elite who caused all your frustrations. This sounds very much like today's headlines, doesn't it? Those stressed out, economically insecure, increasingly marginalized white blue-collar workers. Who are they mad at? Why, the Hispanics, of course. And the immigrants, and transsexuals, blacks, Muslims, and uppity women. Many blue-collar whites are mad at everybody but the elite. The elite who cut their benefits, then closed the factory, stole the workers' pensions, abolished public assistance, made medical care unaffordable, and then slashed their own taxes. Did it even occur to the frustrated whites to bash a Rockefeller? Certainly not. No, let's bash that Spanish-looking guy sitting at the other end of the bar. But back to the movie. One result of frustration aggression is mass murder. This week, our installment begins with the case of mass murderer James Huberty. Huberty shot up a McDonald's restaurant in San Diego back in 1984. He killed 21 people and injured 19 more. He was finally killed by a police sniper. Huberty is a classic case. Anthropologist Elliot Layton has some insightful words on him and other mass murderers, including these insightful words: James Huberty and the like are small potatoes. The real mass murderers are governments and politicians. Amen to that. The film then explores some of the dastardly acts the U.S. government has secretly committed against Americans as our rulers attempted to master the techniques of mind control. Yes, indeed, we're talking about the CIA's infamous Project MKUltra, plus a few dozen other experiments conducted on millions of unwitting Americans. Compared to the Army and the CIA, James Huberty is a rank amateur. But let's begin with Huberty. Comes now our third installment of Scott Noble's film, Human Resources.
the facility, heavily armed, immediately started shooting everybody.
It was a local man dressed in battle fatigues who declared, "I have killed 1,000, I'm going to kill 1,000 more." 41-year-old James Huberty reportedly walked into the restaurant carrying a semi-automatic rifle and two other weapons, enough ammunition to last 2 hours. Witnesses inside said he fired wildly into the unsuspecting crowd gathered for a quick evening meal. He fired through windows, hitting people in the street. He fired at men, women, children, and babies.
Elliot Layton, anthropologist.
There's an interesting perspective that comes out of many studies in psychiatric anthropology, which suggests that mental illness is not just a standardized invarying thing like diabetes, for example. Diabetes is always the same wherever you are in the world, but mental illness seems to take different forms. Once a person takes leave of reality, once a person abandons the ship of fools, the form that the psychosis takes is often dictated or at least shaped by the dominant culture. Thus, for example, in traditional Ojibwe society, where there was a belief that once a person went insane, this is the Wendigo psychosis, that he or she might eat human flesh. And thus a proportion of people who, feeling that they've left reality, no longer feeling control, begin to act out the particular form of psychosis that their culture is aware of. Multiple murderers tend to differ from conventional single murderers. The ordinary murderer is very uniform everywhere in the industrial world. He's very much a bottom of the working class figure. He's addicted to drugs or alcohol. He has no education or professional qualifications. This is the sort of person who, in a fit of rage, kills a friend or a lover. The multiple murders are a little different. They tend to be more edging towards the middle class in their origins and in their aspirations. And a part of their agenda, of their motivation, is that they devoutly wish to join a higher class but come to feel excluded. In the case of James Huberty, the mass murderer who killed more than a dozen people in that long siege at the McDonald's in San Diego, Huberty used to stare from his apartment across the street at McDonald's, which was filled with Mexican immigrants who were seizing control of this fundamental institution, he thought, of American society, who were able to go there and afford to eat when he couldn't. I tried to argue in a succession of books that these kinds of killers, while their acts are deranged and insane, what they themselves are not necessarily so. Rather, they are alienated individuals who wish to end their life in a way that allows them to release their grudge against society for their perceived exclusions. Multiple killers may be statistically rare, but I've tried to argue that they represent central cultural themes. They embody many of the main ideas in their culture, not only the glorification of violence and manly vengeance, but worldly success and worldly ambition, which they feel they've been foiled in. So they're a prime embodiment of their civilization, not a twisted derangement of it. I've also tried to argue that this fundamentally rebellious rather than revolutionary cast to what they're doing, these ghastly killings they perpetrate, are relatively ignored by government institutions charged with regulating society. They typically pay much more attention to real political dangers and spend much less time and energy and money monitoring than this small group of killers. Now, I don't believe personally that the answer to psychopathy is to be found in brain-altering chemicals to change the nature of our society in that artificial way. I think what we ought to start doing is teaching people about the dignity and value and the sacredness of human life and teaching people how to behave towards one another. The important thing to understand, however, is while it's interesting to look into the nature of modern society and see its fissures and fractures and stresses through multiple murderers, it should not be considered that these are the primary killers. Governments and politicians are the main killers. Indeed, some scholars have argued that the state's primary function is as mass murderer, to wage war on other states. And that was how they developed. That's the social impetus for the development of the modern state. So it's kind of disturbing. We don't think of the state in that way, but that's what it is. Hitler and Stalin, between them, killed something like more than 100 million peoples, many of them their own peoples. This small-time, personalized vengeance of a few serial killers and mass killers comes to nothing compared to them. The real killers are governments.
Nowhere is frustration and aggression more apparent than in modern-day military training. In her study of Japanese atrocities in China, Iris Chang observed that Japanese troops were subjected to particularly severe abuse prior to their deployment. They were repeatedly slapped for no reason, humiliated in front of their peers, and reduced to a state of impotent rage. It was generally at this point that they would be given a bayonet and instructed to attack the enemy, who was portrayed as a subhuman animal. In America, the same techniques would be adopted, with the emphasis less on physical abuse than verbal.
Scared. That's pretty much what it boils down to. You have a recruit that is has no idea what the Marine Corps is about. It's that initial shock treatment to let them know that this isn't a summer camp. This isn't where people are coming to have a good time. That we got a real job down here, and that's making United States Marines.
My family was poor. I mean, we used to live on dirt roads, and you know, we used to wear sandals most of the time. Or, I mean, humble. You know, we used to probably wash our same clothes 2 or 3 times a week because that's basically pretty much what we had. I wanted people to see that, you know, this is where I come from, and look at me now. I'm a Marine. I come from the poor side of town. You know, so anybody else could make it as well. There's some type of motivation for my little brothers and my little cousins, something they could look forward to.
Frustration aggression is one of the most effective ways of managing a population. By directing a person's rage against selected minorities or outside enemies, the true cause of an individual's frustration can be effectively diverted. Yet in many ways, the theory is a symptom of something deeper. In order to engender real hatred against a particular group, that group must first be feared. And it is in the realm of fear that behaviorism made its most disturbing contribution.
Hobart Maurer, he would be called a neo-behaviorist, and he trained at the Yale Institute of Human Behavior. And he was quite unusual. I think his background was unusual, and he was also an unusually perceptive and sensitive man. And one of the first and most significant experiments he did was called a preparatory set, in which he had a human being lie down, or usually it was a student, lie down and be attached to electrodes that would deliver a shock whenever a light went on. And then so he would shine the light and then shock the student. And at that point, several people elected to discontinue the experiment. But those who persisted, he would then vary the experiment by showing the light and then not shocking them, or showing the light and shocking them. He would sort of make it unpredictable. And he discovered that people's state of anxiety and fear actually increased when the shock didn't come, when they were just waiting for a shock to come, or when they didn't know if a shock would ever come. And he said it actually created an atmosphere of pervasive fear and anxiety, and he even called it dread or terror.
We have to remind ourselves that we are facing an enemy that is planning all over this world, and it turns out planning inside our country to come here and kill us.
And he said that atmosphere could be ratcheted up progressively the more the experiment continued and the more unpredictable the shocks were, so that after a while, when the shock came, the pain actually was experienced as relief and almost pleasure by the subject. He called it a nervous breakdown, or what he described in another part of the article as the ultimate demoralization of behavior. What he extracted from this experiment was the idea that there was such a thing as a coercive stimulus that could actually be used to create an environment of dread or terror or anxiety from a low to a high level, and that the scientists could actually, it was almost as if they were turning the volume on a stereo, they could decide how much of that atmosphere, how intense they would like it to be.
Needless to say, A creature in a highly fearful environment will be eager to escape to a new environment. This includes human beings. Maurer suggested that new behavior patterns could be quickly created through his techniques. The prospect of creating new behavior patterns quickly and efficiently became an obsession during the Cold War, when the Central Intelligence Agency assumed dominance in the field of mind control experimentation. During the Cold War, the national security state would take the logic of power to its logical conclusion. Known under the umbrella name MKUltra, mind control experimentation by the CIA would abandon any pretense to morality, leading to a nightmarish search for the holy grail of social engineering, a fully controlled, fully obedient human being.
A quote from Aldous Huxley: "The nature of the universe is such that ends can never justify the means. On the contrary, the means always determine the end."
Coming up on Secrets of the Dead, as World War II winds down, the Allies race to capture Hitler's best scientists and technology.
The Black Book had names, targets, places, people. The most important were the scientists, the German scientists.
Searching for rockets, planes, nuclear bombs, and the masterminds behind them. Each side wants the advantage for the looming Cold War. The hunt for Nazi scientists, next on Secrets of the Dead.
The majority of media on the subject of Project Paperclip has centered on German rocket scientists recruited by the United States to prevent the Soviet Union from establishing military supremacy. Hollywood has dealt with the topic in much the same way, often adding humor to the equation. Seldom discussed with equal candor is the recruitment of Nazi scientists who specialized in human experimentation. Among them were Kurt Blom, who tested sarin nerve gas on prisoners at Auschwitz, and Hermann Becker Freising, who conducted fatal experiments at Dachau.
Colin Ross, psychiatrist.
The American people got hold of X number of German scientists, but they immediately ran into a problem. Many of these scientists were classified as war criminals because of their activities during the war, and therefore were not eligible for State Department visas and could not be brought into the United States. So what the CIA did was create several of these different programs, including Paperclip, and their purpose was to, number one, recruit these scientists, and then number two, bring them into the U.S. while routing them around the State Department visa requirements. A well-known doctor who came in under Paperclip was Dr. Albertus Strughold, who did experiments during the Second World War that were full Nazi atrocity-type experiments. For instance, they were interested in the effects of high altitude on human beings, so they built a special chamber. They would put a gypsy or homosexual or a Jew or whoever it might be into the chamber and suddenly drop the pressure down to the equivalent of 60,000 feet. This obviously was excruciating and caused the person to die. And then they would take the guy out of the chamber, dunk his head underwater, and cut his skull open underwater to see if there was air bubbles coming out of the arteries in his brain. And so, yeah, they did dozens and dozens of experiments of this kind. So this guy was brought over under Paperclip, became the father of aviation medicine in the United States, worked at an Air Force base in San Antonio, amongst other locations, has a library named after him at one of the Air Force bases in San Antonio, and the Texas State Legislature declared an Albertus Strughold Day in honor of him back in the 70s.
Whether Nazi scientists participated in experiments on Americans after their recruitment by American intelligence remains unknown. What is known is that such experiments became a matter of routine. Some of the studies were relatively harmless, if unethical. In 1966, the U.S. Army's Special Operations Division dispensed a non-toxic bacillus to the New York City subway system by way of cracked light bulbs. Other experiments were not so harmless.
1946. University of Rochester researchers inject human subjects with uranium in order to study how much they can tolerate before their kidneys become damaged. 1949. Mentally retarded children at the Fernald School in Massachusetts were given radioactive oatmeal in order to test the effects on the human body. 1950, the US Navy secretly sprays a cloud of bacteria over San Francisco. The Navy later claims that the experiment was harmless. Many residents became ill with severe infections, leading to at least one death. The US Army releases a toxic chemical called zinc cadmium sulfide over Minneapolis and other cities. High rates of pneumonia, infant mortality, and cancer occur near dispersal sites. Army doctors study children at local schools, noting the health effects. 1953. The U.S. Atomic Energy Commission sponsors iodine studies at the University of Iowa. Pregnant women are given 100 to 200 microcuries of iodine-131 to determine at what stage radioactive iodine crosses the placental barrier. The aborted fetuses are later studied. 1955. CIA conducts a biowarfare test where bacteria is released into the Tampa Bay area. A sharp rise in whooping cough results, causing 12 deaths. Details of the experiment remain classified. 1956. The U.S. military releases mosquitoes infected with yellow fever over poor communities in Savannah, Georgia, and Haven Park, Florida. Results include stillbirths, encephalitis, typhoid, and several deaths. Following each test, Army agents posing as public health officials test victims for effects. 1957, Operation Plum Bob. The U.S. military detonates bombs at the Nevada test site, northwest of Las Vegas. An estimated 32,000 cases of cancer occur among U.S. civilians due to the experiments. No one is warned.
It was in this environment that U.S. mind control experimentation came into being.
Christopher Simpson, author of The Science of Coercion.
At the end of the war, the OSS was disbanded, and the same personnel really came together and formed the CIA in 1947. And the first documented CIA mind control programs are Bluebird and Artichoke. Bluebird was signed into operation by the director of the CIA in April of 1950, which is 3 months before the start of the Korean War. So all claims that CIA and U.S. interested mind control was purely reactive, purely defensive, and only in reaction to what the communist Chinese were doing to downed pilots during the Korean War, all of that is not true disinformation, clearly disproven by the documents. Artichoke and Bluebird started in 1950, ran into the mid-50s, kind of overlapped with and were rolled into MKUltra, which ran till 1963. MKUltra, in turn, was rolled over into MKSearch, which ran to the early 70s. And in the 50s, 60s, there's a variety of other programs, MKNaomi, MKDelta, QK Hilltop, Project Offen. So there's a whole set of these projects. And the documentation basically stops in 1973. All programs since then are still classified.
Of particular interest were Nazi research papers by Dr. Kurt Plotnow from Dachau concentration camp. Plotner had found that prisoners, when given high doses of mescaline, openly expressed hatred of their captors while also exhibiting an increased willingness to speak frankly about their own lives.
The dream of MKUltra was to come up with drugs that on the one hand would be sort of an ultimate truth serum, that you could give it to a person and they would tell you the truth about anything that you wanted to hear. And then on the other hand, there would also be some way to wipe a person's mind clean.
Heading up the CIA psychochemical experiments would be Sidney Gottlieb. In 1960, when the agency plotted the assassination of Patrice Lumumba, leftist president of the Congo, it was Gottlieb who personally carried the poison to the agency's chief of station via diplomatic pouch. A 1953 memo from Gottlieb states that MKUltra Subproject 6 is designed to develop a reliable source of lysergic acid derivatives within the U.S. The problem of supply was solved in October 1954, when Eli Lilly and Company, now known for manufacturing Prozac, succeeded in synthesizing LSD.
This pill can solve all of your problems. It's called Prozac, and it may mean the end of depression as we know it.
A special memorandum was rushed to CIA Director Alan Dulles on October 26th. And an unlimited supply of the drug was now available to be purchased by, and in some cases used against, the American taxpayer. As with the behaviorists, they started with animals. Here, we see millions of years of evolution turned upside down when a cat is given LSD. Soldiers came next. One of the first major studies was conducted at the Edgewood Chemical Facility in Maryland, where approximately 7,000 U.S. soldiers served as unwitting guinea pigs. They were given drugs such as LSD, mescaline, BZ, and PCP, then instructed to perform various tasks. Looking back at early behaviorist experiments, the analogies were obvious. Under the CIA and the Pentagon, what was good enough for rats was good enough for the U.S. Armed Forces. More than 1,000 of the soldiers emerged with mental health problems. Some attempted suicide. No compensation was offered. In a later experiment, and with the full approval of the National Institute of Health, Gottlieb arranged funding for a project at the Addiction Research Center in Lexington. Heroin addicts, mainly young black men, were kept on LSD for an incredible 77 days, a feat described by the center's director, Harris Isbell, as the most amazing demonstration of drug tolerance I have ever seen. But they would not stop there.
Here we must pause yet again. More on Project MK Ultra and other CIA mind control horrors next week. You've been listening to the documentary film Human Resources on New World Notes. This radio adaptation was made by my friend and colleague Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net. Our own presence on the net is courtesy of the evil empire of Alphabet, Inc., parent of that threat to life, liberty, democracy, and privacy, Google. Alphabet, Inc. is also the parent of blogspot.com, which is where you can find us. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that you got along just fine without smartphones 10 years ago, so what's the problem now? I'm also advising illegitimi non carborundum, and I'm hoping you'll tune in again for more of Human Resources next week. Vaya con Dios!
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. This September 2018 marks the 17th anniversary of the events of 9/11-2001. It also marks 17 years that we haven't been told the truth about what happened on 9/11 by our government and our corporate and some of our foundation-funded alternative media. Fortunately, we have many fellow Americans and other fellow human beings around the planet who have done the research and who have had the courage to go public with their findings. Today, you'll hear from one such man, author and professor Dr. David Ray Griffin. He's now a retired professor of theology from Claremont College in Claremont, California. He's written 12 books on 9/11 and is considered one of the leaders of the 9/11 truth movement. Today, you'll hear the first half of a speech he gave on October 3, 2004, in Santa Rosa, California, after the 9/11 Commission report had been released. He wrote a book about the report called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And if you still believe in the official story of 9/11, I recommend you read it and any of his other books on the topic. He's also just released this month a book called 9/11 Unmasked, which shares the findings of the 9/11 consensus panel, which he started. The 9/11 Commission Report is the official story of what happened on 9/11. In Dr. David Ray Griffin's book, and in the speech you're about to hear, he demolishes that official narrative. So here he is, Dr. David Ray Griffin.
With regard to our topic today, truth and politics, some people may wonder, people maybe outside this room, but is there anything in the 9/11 Commission report that is untrue? And now that I've finished the book, my big question is, can I find a true sentence in the book? That may sound extreme, but if you don't take it too literally, and if you realize a sentence is a part of a paragraph, which is a part of an argument, then it is hard to find any truth there. And so what I'm going to do this afternoon is just go through and give you some examples. One thing to understand about the report is that, you know, we quite often name commissions after the leader. So we had the Rumsfeld Commission on the space program, so on. So quite often this is called the Cain Commission. But it should be called the Cain-Zelikow Commission, because the executive director is Philip Zelikow. He was a member of the Bush 1 administration. He got to know Condoleezza Rice very well there. They both served on the National Security Council. When they were between administrations during the Clinton years, they wrote a book together. When the Bush 2 administration was coming into power, she brought him on to help with the transition. And then he was appointed to the Foreign Advisory Board. So he is essentially a member of the Bush White House. And yet, as executive director, he ran the commission. He had a staff of 70-some. He assigned them which topics were worth looking into and which ones were not. He assigned when people would come and say, I want to testify to the commission, I have something important to say. He would decide who would take that testimony, and so on. Let me give you an example, just one tiny example of how important that is. There's a new book out by Peter Lance called Cover Up. And Peter, good patriot that he is, went to testify because he had some important information about Ramzi Youssef. Remember, the mastermind of the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center. He was also the mastermind of the Bojinka project that they discovered in Manila. And he also was the one who came up with the planes idea of using planes for weapons. So he is the mastermind. Peter went to give testimony, and his testimony was going to contradict some of the things that showed up that were in the prosecution's case in 1996 when they prosecuted Ramzi Youssef. Who took Peter Lance's testimony? Dietrich Schnell, one of the two prosecutors of that trial. So that is an example of how the executive director could skew. And Peter said he got a mole inside the commission, somebody who was very unhappy on the staff, who was unhappy with the way things were going. And they would meet, and he would tell Peter what was going on. And he said that Zelikow just runs the whole commission, that there are these leadership teams, and 6 out of the 7 teams, he said, are completely controlled by Zelikow. Only one team, run by John Farmer, was not, and they were butting heads all the time. There are other examples, like at the commission report, people would say, tell us about the war games. And they would ask the commissioners, why didn't you deal with the war games? And the commissioners said, oh, well, we were told that was unimportant. Well, by whom were they told? So you essentially have the 9/11 commission, it's the White House investigating itself. And furthermore, as Peter points out, the staff, you know, you think, oh, well, they got a staff there. It's a bunch of people who know how to do research. They probably got, you know, university students and so on. No. Ex-FBI, ex-CIA, ex-Department of Justice, 9 members from the Department of Justice. Ashcroft, yeah. So they've got their friends back on there. So when you wonder, why are no names named? Got people on there protecting their friends, protecting their institutions that they're still proud of, or they want to be have the public to have a good point. So from the very beginning, this was a doomed commission. It was not a commission to get the truth. Once you realize that, these things won't shock you quite as much. But even then, even knowing that, I was still shocked at the number of omissions and the audacity of some of the distortions. So let me go through some of these. Starting right out on the very first pages, they start telling you about the hijackers. What they don't tell you, and they give you the names, and in the middle of the book you can see their pictures. What they don't tell you is that at least six of those men are still alive. Some of them have, like Waleed al-Shira, walked into the embassy and said, here I am, I'm not dead. Nevertheless, and some of them were interviewed by the BBC and London newspapers, and nevertheless, they're in there, and this Waleed al-Shira, they have him on flight 11, and they say, we believe he's one of the ones who stabbed some of the people who were stabbed. Just a total disregard of well-known facts. Just omit that there's any problem with the identity of the hijackers. Likewise, they fail to mention, Daniel Hofstetter has written a whole book about Muhammad Atta, showing he was not a devout Muslim. You know, the image we have, here are these radical fundamentalist Muslims, they're ready to meet their maker. Atta loved alcohol, pork, and prostitutes. And the commission says, we're puzzled. Why did these guys go to Las Vegas? We've not found any credible reason. Well, they loved lap dances, you know. Another alleged hijacker is Hani Hanjour. And they tell us he was chosen to fly Flight 77, the one that was going to hit the Pentagon, because he was their best pilot. Hani Hanjour could not fly any kind of airplane. He would go up in his lessons, and the next time the guy wouldn't go up with him. He says, you can't fly. He was known as a horrible pilot, even with a little plane. And yet he was alleged to fly this Boeing 757 and make this amazing spiral, come down and come in at ground level, 400 miles an hour, into the Pentagon. The best pilots in the world, some of them have looked at that and said, I don't think I could do that. Hani Hanjour could not fly. This one they do mention. It's a funny thing. They mention this and then they just ignore it. And they have President Bush amazed, you know, boy, this was some pilot, you know. The flight manifest. We've never publicly seen flight manifests that show that any of the... So it's not just the six. We don't know that any of the 19 men named were actually on these flights. None of this is mentioned. It's not mentioned and refuted. It's just not mentioned. So that's why I call it omissions. And some people call it the 9/11 Omission Commission. Let me give another example. World Trade Center. They hardly discuss the question of these enormous buildings coming down. They don't discuss any of the problems. One problem is, never before in history have steel-framed high-rise buildings collapsed because of fire. Now, some people say, well, one just fire, these big planes hit them. Well, people who've looked at this said that's insignificant. Besides, no plane hit building number 7, which is a 47-story skyscraper, and it came down also. Furthermore, even if you were going to have fire weaken a building, it would have to be enormous fires. They would have to be very hot, not ordinary hydrocarbon fires that you get from kerosene, which is what jet fuel is. And they would have to be very long-lasting. These fires didn't last. The South Tower came down in 57 minutes. There's an enormous amount of steel in a 110-story building that is steel-framed inside and outside. And yet they're telling us these. Now, the only thing they mention here, they mention that South Tower collapsed in 10 seconds. Can you imagine how fire would bring down a 110-story building in free-fall speed? And that's what it is. Also, the wrong tower collapsed first. The north tower was hit first. And so if it's fire that's bringing it down, it takes a while for the fire to heat up the steel. So the north tower should have collapsed first. The south tower also had a much smaller fire because the plane hit it at the angle, at the corner, and so most of the fuel went outside and burned up. So that enormous fireball you see, you say, boy, what an enormous fire. Well, yeah, for about 15 seconds. And it's burned up, and so there's not much fuel to keep the fire going in the South Tower. And yet, it collapses within 57 minutes. One of the places where you just know they're absolutely lying and cheating is they give you an account that makes it sound plausible that these towers could have come down. They tell you that in the core of each building was a hollow shaft that was just filled with elevators and staircases. Yeah. And 47 massive steel columns. That's what the World Trade, these buildings were all about. This was this unique structure at the time. These 47 massive steel things going up into the air. So massive at the bottom. So even if you accepted the official theory, which is a pancake theory, that somehow the connectors between the columns in the middle and then the peripheral beams around the building, somehow those snapped and then the floors came down and that floor was so heavy it hit the net and it just went down. Can you imagine that happening in 10 seconds? And even if it did, just like if in the old records, when the records fell on the spindle, and those of you who are old enough to remember those, the spindle's still there. So why aren't those 47 towers still sticking up in the air, but the pictures show they totally collapse. You have something that's no more than 3 stories high. I mean, just total dishonesty to deny the existence of those massive columns. And then they don't even mention that building number 7 collapsed. There's not a word about it. Everybody admits there is no explanation for why building number 7 collapsed. In most cities, this would have been the biggest building, 47 stories high. It can be ignored only because it was next to the towers. And FEMA says, they come up with this lame explanation of how this building came down. They said, the only explanation we can come up with has a very low probability of occurrence. That there's no answer. So they, rather than telling you, like an honest report would, we're surprised, we're puzzled why building number 7 collapsed. There's no good answer. They just don't even mention that it collapsed. They don't tell you that Larry Silverstein, the owner virtually of the building and the builder of it, said on a PBS report, well, at a certain point, the fire chief and I got together and we said, you know, there's been so much loss of life, let's not take any chances, and we decided to pull it.
Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it, and they made that decision to pull.
Pull it is the slang for bringing it down by controlled demolition. So he admits it in public. It's well known. It's mentioned in any, like my book and other books and all the books that people sent to the commission, assuming they wanted to know the truth. And they don't mention, they don't bring in Larry Silverstein and say, why did you say that? What did you mean by that? Isn't that what a commission looking for the truth might do? Likewise, Giuliani said, we knew that the towers were going to collapse, so we got the people out of building number 7. How did he know the tower? Buildings have never collapsed before in history. How could have he known the Twin Towers were going to collapse? They didn't ask him that. They treated him as a hero when he comes into the commission. They fell all over themselves, praising Rudy Giuliani as the great hero. So what I'm getting at here, those of you who haven't read it, is that all three collapses were pretty close to classic examples of what they call controlled demolition. When dynamite or some kind of explosives are placed throughout the building at all the crucial points, and then they put them on a computer and they bring them down in a certain order, and therefore the building comes straight down so it doesn't fall on these other buildings, and they come down in virtually free fall speed. And that's what happened here. All three buildings. You can see them on all sorts of places on the website. You don't see them on TV anymore. They showed them the first night, and Dan Rather, you know, bless his soul, comes right out and blurts out the truth. He says, "Boy, that looks just like controlled demolition." The 9/11 Commission also does not tell you that Marvin Bush, the president's brother, and their cousin, Ward Walker, were the principals of the company that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center. All sorts of coincidences here. They also don't tell you that there were many reports of people who worked in the building saying, you know, we got a shutdown order, so for 3 days we couldn't go in the World Trade Center. There were engineers coming in and out. We didn't know it. Okay, moving right along to the Pentagon. They don't tell you that. They do mention that it was the west wing of the Pentagon that was hit. They don't mention that for terrorists who wanted to really strike a blow at the Pentagon, the west wing was the least likely part to hit. Why? Because all the big brass are in the east wing. That's where Rumsfeld and all the top generals are. Furthermore, the west wing was being renovated. So it was reinforced so the fire wouldn't spread to the rest of the building. Also, there were very few people there. And so, although it's tragic that 125 people on the ground were killed, several thousand would have been killed if the plane had hit any other... Well, if it had been a plane, we'll come to that later. But even what it was, it would have killed several hundred and maybe thousand if it had been an ordinary place. And also, terrorists would want to kill Pentagon workers. Most of the people killed were civilians who were there working on their renovation. Furthermore, as I said, it was the hardest place of the Pentagon to hit. You've got this huge Pentagon here with acres. All you had to do was fly right into the ceiling, right into the roof, and you would have done, you couldn't have missed. Even Hani Hanjour could have hit it. And all you had to do was hit the East Wing. And, you know, remember how smart these terrorists were? These were masterminds. And yet they didn't know that the West Wing wasn't where you would want to hit. Why don't they just release the videos and show us? You know, there are cameras there, cameras on hotels next door. There's a camera in the gas station across the street. All you have to do is show us the videos and you can prove it was a Boeing 757. No, they didn't show us any. They finally, after Thierry Masson came out with his theory that it wasn't a Boeing but a missile, they released 5 frames that they said proved it. Some people have looked at those frames and said, that's when I became a skeptic because that was not a Boeing, even though they tried to make it look like it. Furthermore, this video that was across the street, within 5 minutes of the attack, the FBI was over there and confiscated it. You would think the FBI would be distraught. Hey, for the first time in history, the Pentagon has been hit. No, they had the presence of mind to get in their cars and drive over there and confiscate the video. We've never seen it. 9/11 Commission, of course, doesn't mention any of this. How could a Boeing, a commercial airliner, attack the Pentagon? Wouldn't you have batteries of missiles surrounding the Pentagon so that any airplane that doesn't have a military transponder radiate friendly, would be shot down? Of course, that's exactly the situation. And yet, whatever it was that hit the Pentagon goes right through. Then, one of the most dishonest things in the commission report is they actually bring this up. Because one of the criticisms have been, these flights that were going to New York, they passed by one of the biggest nuclear plants right along the river there. All they had to do was attack that. That would have caused far more devastation than any of these attacks on the World Trade Center. It would have, killed hundreds of thousands of people, poisoned the area, ruined the economy of the United States, if that's what these terrorists wanted to do, because they hate freedom and democracy. But they didn't. They flew right over it and went and hit the World Trade Center. So what does the 9/11 Commission tell you? Well, they have this guy named, they call him KSM, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And they've captured him, they tell us. Well, he's this font of information. And they just say anything they want to, and they say, this is what KSM told us. We have no way of checking this. They just tell us, he was the mastermind. So what he told him was, well, yeah, we thought about hitting a nuclear plant, but, we said, they're probably guarded. They probably have missiles around there. We'd probably get shot down. So let's go hit the Pentagon. It's surely... And I hate to say it, I'm not making this up. So when you hear that this report is the number one bestseller of the year, and also you go on Amazon and look at the reports, the ratings, customer ratings, at least the last time I looked, 9 out of 10 were 5 stars. People are saying, now we know the truth. And yet, this is comic book stuff. When you know what the truth is, you know all these other reports that they've ignored. It's almost comic book writing. No, that's not true. This is true. How do we know it? Well, because KSM told us, or because we have this transcript. But of course, it will be put in the vault for 50 years, and you'll never be able to see it. With the Warren Commission, they published all the supporting documents. Whatever you can say about the Warren Commission, you can say a lot about the Warren Commission. And Max Cleland said, I'm not going to be part of another Warren Commission cover-up. And he wasn't. The president got him a job, another job. And so you got Max Cleland off the commission, and so you got a unified report. They're very proud. We published this without dissent. They just give you all these reports, and yet in the notes in the back, and these are authoritative, and yet there's nothing that you can go to check these reports, because they're in the hands of the FBI or they're in the hands of other people. You can't check out anything they say, unlike the Warren Commission. At least you could see the testimony. Okay, President Bush on 9/11. You would think, we've seen these movies about the Secret Service. These guys are really highly trained. And if there's the slightest danger to the president, they get in front of him. If there's the slightest danger that this route is not good, you change the route, and so on and so on. Here's the president down in Sarasota in the classroom. And, of course, a lot of you have seen that in the Michael Moore movie. And he sits there, and he sits there, and he sits there after they've told him about the second tower. After the first tower was hit, he says, oh, boy, what a horrible accident. So they just go on like, oh, this was a little plane and it flew in. But after the second one, there could be no doubt, but America was under a terrorist attack. I mean, given the official story, could be no doubt about that. So why didn't the Secret Service whisk him out of there? Because if these were terrorists and they wanted to attack the symbols of America, what better target than the President of the United States? So the Secret Service would have immediately said, we're next. We're going to be targeted next. They're there in an empty school. There's no fighter cover over. The president is completely unprotected. So the 9/11 Commission said, well, we asked the Secret Service, why did you let the president stay there another half hour? And they said, well, we thought it would look bad if we got up and ran out of the room. Yeah, well, it would look bad if the president of the United States got murdered on your watch because you didn't do your job, too. But they accepted that. And like the only alternatives were get him up and rush him out of the room, like Cheney said they did to him. Could it be that they think Cheney's more important than Bush? No. Let's not go there. That story about Cheney is probably apocryphal anyway. So, but that's what the Secret Service is supposed to do when there's a real danger. So they said, well, we didn't want to rush him out of the room. So they left him there for 30 minutes. How about something in between, like, excuse us, the president must leave. He's been called to other duties. And you walk out of the room. So the commission didn't press him on that. They just accepted that answer. And time again, I use that as an illustration, they accept the most really the silliest answers from these authoritative figures, and very seldom do they press. And the few times they do press, it gets deleted from the final report. And that's the other thing to know about Zelikow. He was the editor. He was in charge of the final report. And so it's pretty consistent. I've only found two or three inconsistencies in the parts of the book that I've read. So it clearly had to be finally one mind who was in charge of this. And he's my candidate. Advance warnings. No mention of the fact that Willie Brown was warned not to fly on an airplane that day. No discussion of why Ashcroft quit flying commercial planes suddenly. No mention that David Shippers, you remember who David Shippers? He prosecuted President Clinton. You'd think he'd be very popular in Republican circles. And so if David Shippers called up Attorney General Ashcroft and says, hey, I've got a serious problem here. I've got some FBI agents who tell me there's going to be an attack on Lower Manhattan, and Ashcroft will not return his call. Week after week after week, Shippers tries repeatedly. These FBI agents, they said, we knew over a month ahead of time the target and the date. Were they interviewed by the 9/11 Commission? Let's see if these guys are reputable. Let's put them under lie detector tests. No, no mention whatsoever. The National Security Agency tells us that they intercepted this message from KSM to Muhammad Atta on September 10th, giving him the go-ahead to do the planes operation. But they said we didn't get around to translating it until September 12th, so of course we didn't know. Wouldn't you think maybe you would put somebody under a lie detector test and say, did you really not translate that? No, no mention of that. The put options. For those of you who don't know, to buy a put option, you're betting that a company's stock value is going to plummet. And if you buy at the right time and then it goes way down, and you buy a lot of that stock, you can make millions, tens of millions of dollars. So an enormous number of put options were purchased on American Airlines, United Airlines, and Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which had 22 floors of the World Trade Center, just the 3 or 4 days prior to 9/11. So first of all, the CIA monitors this stuff. So if they're going to say no advance warning, here's the clearest sign in the world that United and American Airlines are going to be used to attack the World Trade Center. What could be clearer? They don't discuss that. All they say is, well, there's been a lot of hullabaloo about the put options, but we checked it out, and we found that this was not advanced knowledge because, and that's the accusation, of course, that it was insider trading and somebody had advanced knowledge. And they say, no, because we found the agency that bought 95% of the United Airlines share, and it was somebody who had no conceivable connection to Al-Qaeda. So you see the circular argument. The official story is that the commission started with and ended with is that the operation was pulled off entirely by Al-Qaeda and that nobody else knew about it. And so if this guy didn't have a pipeline to Al-Qaeda, he couldn't have possibly, it was just a lucky guess.
And again, you were just listening to a speech given by Dr. David Ray Griffin on October 3rd, 2004 in Santa Rosa, California. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that speech. And just a reminder, 9/11 wake-up calls are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. And the easiest way to find my shows, if you click on Contributors and look under the C's for Cheryl. And the show should pop up in chronological order. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And this is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with
Ken Nash.
Which side are you on? The story of Bisbee, Arizona's ethnic cleansing of 1,300 immigrant mine workers. The lessons of then for now.
And to set the pace, we have the Bisbee deportation of 1917, a short documentary by high school students.
They have herded us like cattle, torn us from our homes and wives. Yes, we've heard their rifles rattle and have feared for our lives. It was in the morning early of that fatal July 12th, and the year 1917, this took place, of which I tell.
On July 12, 1917, Arizona's Cochise County Sheriff Harry Wheeler and nearly 2,000 men deported striking copper miners in Bisbee to Columbus, New Mexico against their will. The Bisbee deportation was a turning point economically, politically, and socially for the town of Bisbee, the state of Arizona, the country, and the world. In 1877, men marching through Tombstone Canyon in southeastern Arizona discovered copper. After Phelps Dodge, a dominant copper company, acquired social power, pro-management Republican Thomas Campbell was able to become the second governor of Arizona over Hunt in the election of 1916, foretelling a major misfortune for the unions.
And as individual, one small cog in a large corporation, they quickly realized that if they were losing their identity with a craft, with a skill, and they were losing their ability to negotiate.
In April 1917, the United States broke its neutrality with Europe and entered World War I. Prices of copper and working hours soared, while the rate of pay for the miners went up only a trifle. Meanwhile, the industrial workers of the world, also known as the IWW, finally succeeded in establishing their union in Bisbee. Upset at capitalistic companies such as Phelps Dodge, the IWW and supporting miners gave the mining companies a list of grievances and demands for better working conditions. Management furiously refused the demands. The IWW called a peaceful strike on June 27th for all workers until management met their stipulations. Anti-union propaganda was used all over the state against the IWW. Walter Douglas, president of Phelps Dodge, said, "An infected sore may well become a cancer if it is not cut out."
As World War I progressed, Bisbee, like the rest of the country, got caught up not only in the fervor of the war, but they also became convinced, because of their proximity to the Mexican border and the civil conflict, much of it in northern Mexico, that there was a real serious threat to the community.
Capitalists held numerous meetings to organize a deportation of striking miners. Sheriff Harry Wheeler was put in charge of gathering the men. During the preparation process, men and women were brought over from a strike in Cornwall, England, to replace the deported men in the Bisbee mining camps. Guns were handed out to deputies. A train consisting of 23 cattle cars was provided for the deportation, and a telegram office was ordered to disconnect all means of communication. Finally, on July 12, 1917, the deportation took its place in history. By 6:30 a.m., nearly 2,000 vigilantes clad with white handkerchiefs around their arms were storming the streets and barging into strikers' homes. Men were dragged from their beds at gunpoint to the picket lines before they even knew what was happening. Women and children were brutally attacked if they interfered. Many deputies stole money and personal items while they raided the homes. Only two deaths occurred. However, they were the result of a personal affair between a deputy and a striker. The rounded up men were gathered at Downtown Plaza and later marched in two lines to Warren Ballpark by the rifle-armed loyal Americans. The deportees were simply asked one question: "Are you working?" The men that gave in were sent home, while those who stood up for their pro-union beliefs were loaded aboard one of 23 cattle boxcars ordered by Phelps Dodge. Manure covered the floors of the cattle trains, and it was so overcrowded that the doors had to be left open. By midday, the deportation was in full progress, with 186 guards on top of the trains to escort the men on their extensive journey. After 52 hours, the men were unloaded and deserted 20 miles from Columbus, New Mexico. Bill Cleary, a Bisbee pro-labor news reporter and deportee, kept accounts that showed that although the deportation was pointed at the IWW, many deportees were not even union members.
Picked them up and hauled them down there. In one particular time, I was talking to an old boy on Murray Gulch up there at the bar one day, and they talked up about that roundup. He said, "Yeah," he says, I got picked up and he was a gambler.
Approximately 1,186 men were deported. Back in Bisbee, a vigilance committee posted an armed blockade around Bisbee to jail and exile those who disagreed with the authoritative companies. President Wilson sent the Federal Mediation Committee, created specifically to investigate labor problems throughout the country, to Bisbee. Results of their study were specific. Companies' actions were, quote, wholly illegal and without authority in law, either state or federal, end quote. After 6 months, the government of Arizona stopped both additional deportations of men and put an end to the illegal committee acting as authority in place of the government. Although the deportation had physically ended, it left a permanent footstep in the sands of history.
Unions were ousted from Bisbee and would remain absent for nearly two decades. The deportation did, however, immediately spark efforts to organize unions across the nation. With the power Phelps Dodge gained from the deportation, it was able to buy out the Calumet and Arizona Mining Company and dominate Bisbee's copper industry. The deportation lowered copper output by 50%, yet new technology introduced immediately after the deportation, such as a steam shovel, helped overcome the deficiency. But as one Bisbee citizen once said, whether right, wrong, or necessary, Bisbee never forgot the management-labor conflict of 1917.
What a beautiful little piece done by students, and indeed students who Catherine Benton Cohn can tell us something about. Catherine Benton Cohn joins us now. She's a professor of history, the Institute for the Study of International Migration at Georgetown University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, actually, it's just a total coincidence that I was in an archive at Arizona State University, which is actually in my hometown of Tempe, Arizona. And this was, gosh, a very long time ago. I think I was a graduate student. And I ran into that young pair of high school students who I am, if I'm recalling correctly, I think are from Mesa, Arizona, which was the neighboring town, public high school there, and were working on a National History Day project, which ended up, I think, winning Arizona's prize that year and going on to compete nationally. And it was a terrific piece. As I was re-listening to it, I think they really hit a lot of the main points.
Well, one of the points that they really didn't get into is the matter of race.
Yes.
And that was a major point for about half of the strikers. So why don't you tell us more about the strikers and what the issues were?
Absolutely. So just to review in just a sentence what they talked about, it's true that in actually, June 26, 1917, the Industrial Workers of the World, or WOBLIs as they're better known, the IWW, the Radical Industrial Union led by folks like Big Bill Haywood, called a strike in the copper camp of Bisbee, Arizona. The U.S. had been in World War I for a couple of months. By all accounts, that strike was peaceful, but on the morning of July 12, 1917, just as the kids said, about 2,000 armed deputies, I'm going to use that in quotation marks, led by Sheriff Harry Wheeler, a very popular, democratically elected sheriff, Democrat, rounded up about 1,200 men and shipped them into the middle of the New Mexico desert, where they were rescued by an army camp that had been set up the year before because of Pancho Villa's raid. So this event is very well known in labor history circles, and it's been treated a lot of different ways over the years. But in more recent years, historians have noticed, and of course myself among them, but I'm not the only one, that this group, 90% of them were immigrants. And we might expect, if we were to telescope sort of today's headlines about the border backwards, we might think they were all Mexicans. But what's interesting is that about half of them were Mexicans or Mexican-Americans. I say that because many of them were U.S. citizens. But a very large number of them were from Eastern and Southern Europe. And in fact, the men that were deported that day came from about three dozen different countries. Bisbee had a large Serbian population, for example, who large enough, maybe about 1,200 people, large enough that there's a Serbian Orthodox Church in Bisbee. There were Finns. In fact, the Finns were kind of known mining radicals. The WOBLIs met at Finn Hall. But the thing that was highly racialized about this incident is that the quote-unquote deputies were overwhelmingly white or Anglo, as we'd say in Arizona, American citizens, or were English or Irish immigrants. They cleave to a very particular sense of American patriotism that caused them to make assumptions about the kind of loyalty of these strikers, when in fact, many of the strikers, as I mentioned, were American citizens. Many had bought Liberty bonds for World War I. It's true the Wobblies were officially opposed to World War I. But the big thing that I argue was sort of the one thing, the one strike demand that managers absolutely could not abide, was that what were called surface workers, the men who worked on the top of the mine rather than underground in the more elite, skilled jobs, and we might think of those as worse jobs, but those were actually sort of better paid and more highly socially valued. But the surface workers were predominantly Mexican, and one of the demands of the strikers was that the surface workers would make $5.50 a day, and the underground workers would make $6 a day, whereas at the time they made about half what the underground workers made. So, in effect, that strike demand was to erase the racial hierarchy that existed in the mine wages and system in a town that very proudly called itself what was called a white man's camp. There were white man's camps all over the American West, so-called lumber camps or mining camps that called themselves that. And we know the fiction of race because they each defined themselves differently, what that meant. In Bisbee, white man's camp meant that Mexican men could not work in underground jobs and that no Chinese were allowed to live in town at all. It was what the historian James Lowen wrote a long book about, called a Sundown Town, where Asians could come in, Chinese could come in and sell, say, vegetables and fruits during the day, but they could not live in Bisbee, and Mexicans could not have underground mining jobs.
Catherine, one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is just contextualizing this in the terms of the 1917 immigration law that was passed.
Right.
That I know had a great deal to do with the Asian Pacific Islander population.
Right.
But nevertheless, was a law that was the most punitive of its kind, really, that had been passed in the history of immigration laws in this country, and lasted up until the time of, what was it, the McCarran Act of
all
things.
In some respects, yes, that's right.
So could you tell us a little bit about that and how you think this plays out within that context of that vastly xenophobic, awful immigration law?
Sure, and I'm really happy to answer that question because my first book, Borderline Americans, on which my research for this new film, Bisbee 17, is based, is about the Arizona-Mexico border and the history of race. But I've actually just written a book called Inventing the Immigration Problem that looks at something called the Dillingham Commission, the largest study of immigrants ever conducted in U.S. history, a federal commission that wrote 41 volumes of reports from 1907 to 1911. And the data that they show in the reports is actually quite equivocal about immigrants, but the recommendations they made were very harsh. And the biggest recommendation they made, their top priority, was a literacy test. And the 1917 law created a literacy test for immigrants for the first time. And it also created what you're referring to, the Asiatic barred zone, which barred most of Asia from immigrating to the United States. It actually had a map. That map actually went around Japan, because we already had the gentleman's agreement with Japan, so they felt like they didn't need to include that in the new rules. But you're right, these were very... these rules went far beyond what earlier immigration laws had done. A couple things that are really interesting about that with respect to Bisbee in particular. First of all, this isn't specific to Bisbee, but it's important to note in our xenophobic moment right now, in some ways that literacy test was not as bad as it sounds. You only needed to be literate in your own language. And they did allow, for example, Yiddish. So... It was hoped by the people who passed the literacy test that it would exclude large numbers of people from Southern and Eastern Europe, who many people found very undesirable. And, of course, they were the largest stream of immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th century, right, pouring into the Lower East Side and Little Italy and so on. But it turns out it didn't actually keep that many people out. But to return to its relevance in Bisbee, this is a fascinating story that a lot of people don't know about. As the law was written, it applied to Mexicans crossing the border. But as soon, and that law passed just very, very quickly before World War One, the U.S. entered World War One. Anyway, what happened is, as Southwestern employers, especially in the copper mines, which were producing war material for World War One, and agricultural employers, right, who employed large numbers of Mexican migrant workers in the Southwest, they pestered and lobbied and harangued Congress to make an exception and let Mexicans cross the border without passing a literacy test because they felt they had such a demand for workers in the wartime industries. And so the Secretary of Labor made an exception for Mexicans and let them come without passing the literacy test. So some people reported in Bisbee that there were hundreds of new Mexican workers pouring in the spring and early summer of 1917, and that was a direct consequence of this exception that was made in law by the Secretary of Labor.
So what happened to the unionized workers who were transported out of state and left in the desert? And what happened to the town immediately after that?
So that's a really good question, and I hope your listeners will really think about what this would do to a community. At the time, Bisbee was a buzzing, thriving, busy, productive town of about 25,000. It had a streetcar system. It had beautiful schools. It had families. It had a YMCA and a YWCA. So picture that 2,000 men were armed deputies, about 1,200 men were deported. So that's already 3,300 adult men who are literally either holding a gun or at gunpoint, right, being marched out of town, right? And you got to figure, so only half the town is male, that's 12,000 people, and many of them are children. So you're talking about basically a majority of adult males are directly involved in this event, right? This is literally all hands on deck. What happened to those men is that they were abandoned on it's still the Amtrak line from Benson, Arizona, from southern Arizona to El Paso, Texas. You can still take that route. I've taken it myself. My grandparents lived in El Paso, Texas. It was a company-owned railroad at the time. It was owned by the Phelps Dodge Company, and they left them at a rail stop there. And they were taken in by an army camp, Camp Furlough, that had been erected there the year before because Pancho Villa, the famous Mexican revolutionary, had invaded, made a raid on the border town of Columbus, New Mexico. And so that camp was created because of Pancho Villa's raid. However, most of the U.S. Army was busy in Mexico chasing him down. And so there was hardly anyone at the camp, and they took basically these Chinese camp cooks and African-American Buffalo soldiers took in these 1,200 men and fed them and clothed them. Some of them stayed for 2 months. As the young student said in your intro, those folks were not ever allowed back in Bisbee. There's a wonderful local historian named Mike Anderson in Bisbee who has studied with some data I helped provide him what happened to the deportees, and we don't think any more than a couple dozen ever came back to Bisbee ever again. They were not allowed to come back, and a committee of kind of pro-company wives, wives of mining officials and the company doctor, gave out so-called relief, gave, you know, money and groceries and one-way tickets out of town to the hundreds of wives and children of the deportees.
Wow, and we also have, I know, two people that were killed in the roundup. And if you
That's
can
right.
tell us about them. And was there any prosecution
yes.
of any of these people that were involved in this heinous vigilante ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, so a couple of things. The two men who were killed are actually the subject of one of the short films you can find on Bisbee17.com. It is in the film, but there's more treatment of that incident in a short film that Robert Greene created on his website. It's very interesting. So those two men, one was a wobbly, or at least one was being rounded up, as it were, and one was one of the deputies, and they had an incident while the roundup was happening and opened fire on one another. And there's a very moving depiction of it and the debates around it that's worth watching on the film. In some ways, though, I think it's astonishing more people were not killed when you think about the chaos of this and how many people were armed. It's really astonishing to me that only two men died. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Well, I guess I'm not even sure anymore, but what I'm interested in is the legacy. I had actually asked, I recall now, whether or not anybody was prosecuted.
Oh, yeah. I can answer that very quickly. The prosecution question is an interesting one. There were attempts to prosecute. There was both a civil case where deportees sued the mining companies and deputies. They actually had a civil suit where they named men that they knew were, you know, gunmen and tried to get redress. And Phelps Dodge apparently worked up an offer, and I'm not checking these numbers, but they're not wildly off base, where it was something like, you know, $750 if you were married and $400 if you were single, you know, something along those lines, where they had worked out a settlement, but they had not signed the agreement. And in the meantime, there was a state kidnapping trial, and the defense for the deputies argued, he made this up basically, he said there was a law of necessity that required that they restore order in their town, what we would understand to be vigilante justice, and the men were found not guilty on state kidnapping charges. And once Phelps Dodge and the mining companies realized that they had won the criminal suit, they refused to settle in the civil suit. And so there was no legal redress ever. However, and I'll get to your legacy point in just a second, because in some ways that's what the movie is about. President Wilson was pressured, as those young kids mentioned, to create a presidential mediation commission that went and investigated a number of labor incidents across the mining West and lumber West in the fall of 1917. And they spent a lot of time in Bisbee, and one of the people on that commission was a young Felix Frankfurter. I think he was still in his 20s or early 30s, and was a Harvard Law professor and an assistant secretary of labor, and he served on that commission, and he mentions it in labor decisions that he later makes on the U.S. Supreme Court of having this incredible impact on him. So I guess you could say that was one legacy. The long-term legacy is that, as the film discusses with great emotion, that most people could never talk about it in town ever again. And as a historian, there's, for me, one of the wonderful moments in this film is a woman who's descended from a company family who says, all I ever heard was that it was a really good thing and that there would have been blood on the streets and that they cleaned it up and it was necessary. And then she pauses. She's a really bright and well-educated person with a degree in history. And she said, but of course I only ever heard the company side, because the deportees weren't around to tell their side of the story.
Catherine, in terms of still of legacy, so if one goes into Bisbee today, could these same events happen? Is this really, how easy is it to rev up the hysteria and scapegoat immigrant workers? Is Bisbee still alive and well as a lesson to reckon with?
Wow. Well, it's certainly, I feel confident saying this would never happen in Bisbee anytime soon, because Bisbee is a hippie, left-wing, funky artist colony that very much supported this airing of dirty laundry and sort of thinking it through. But with respect, because they also know that they have all kinds of descendants of miners and there. And that's part of what is beautiful to me as a historian about the film, is the way that history still affects us today. Do I think this could happen in other communities? I don't think I know that any better than you do. You know, historians don't like to be prognosticators. I certainly think that in some ways, you know, the language around immigrants today is even worse than it was in 1917.
And I keep thinking about Joseph Arpaio, even though
right,
he wasn't
Joe Arpaio.
Elected. Of course, Sheriff Joe Arpaio,
right.
et cetera.
Yeah. But, I mean, Harry Wheeler was a much more complicated figure than Joe Arpaio, actually. And he's treated with respect in the film of thinking about he was a sheriff who had been elected with labor support, was very popular, but also thought of him as this, himself as this sort of Western lawman. You know, he patrolled, he was in charge of a county that had 90 miles of border with Mexico, and Mexico was having a revolution. And the mining companies were very, very powerful, you know. And that was not a great position for him to be in.
So in the last minute that we have left in the realm of Trump, what are the lessons and what can we understand and what must we be wary of, since I do wonder how much more it would take for people to literally oust, to round up, to take vigilante
right.
action, because clearly that is by that's what's being revved up. So the lessons that you think we need
well,
to
take
me, from
one
this.
Warning that I would make as a historian, because I think you could get any sort of, you know, person on the left to talk about the warnings, but as a historian, I would say be very wary of huge generalizations about what this country has done or not done with respect to immigrants. I mean, I just finished writing a book about a moment in which we passed the national origins quotas, which were deeply racist, right, and deeply discriminatory. And I honestly think much of the rhetoric today is as bad or worse than what we heard in 1917. By the same token, we had nearly open borders at that time, right? So, you know, just be wary about anybody making huge generalizations about, you know, back then they learned English or my grandparents came legally. Those answers, those realities are much more complicated, and we should really be careful about calling on, you know, false histories to serve political agendas.
And the film that Catherine's been referencing throughout this discussion is a new film called Bisbee 17. It's great.
And the director-producer of that is Robert Greene, Bisbee 17. Catherine Bentencone, you are going to come back to talk to us much more about all of this, aren't you? Because and to have a discussion on your books as well.
It I would love to do that, of course.
Oh, great. You're wonderful. You're vivacious. You're bright. You're energizing.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
It's Halloween, it's Halloween. So get your scary costume on and come with me.
We're looking at it. We have a lot of different
concepts right now?
The Trump administration may believe that it can rewrite rules so that transgender people are no longer in the law. It certainly cannot write trans people out of existence.
This isn't a debate. It doesn't violate anyone else's rights for trans people to have rights.
We will stand up, we will be resilient, and we will be here long after this administration is in the trash heap.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Trump attacks trans existence on national and global fronts. Britain's Commons pressures Northern Ireland on marriage equality. And musical hocus pocus for a happy Halloween. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Sarah Sweeney.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 27th, 2018. During a week when a rabid supporter of Donald Trump sent pipe bombs to at least 14 of the president's high-profile critics, his administration launched three separate attempts to redefine transgender people out of existence. His first effort was literally global. According to an exclusive report in the Guardian newspaper, the U.S. mission to the United Nations is trying to eliminate the word gender from all of the international body's human rights documents, replacing it with woman in most cases. U.S. diplomats at recent meetings of the UN's Third Committee, which addresses social, humanitarian, and cultural rights, have been arguing that current policy is driven by ideology-based political correctness to treat gender as variable rather than as an unchanging biological fact. For example, The Guardian notes, the U.S. proposed replacing phrases like gender-based violence with violence against women in a draft paper on human trafficking. One unidentified senior U.N. diplomat told the paper that if you only say violence against women, it doesn't really tell the whole story. The newspaper says that the only way the U.S. delegation will get its way is by forging alliances with Russia and conservative, predominantly Muslim nations against its usual Western allies.
Trump's Solicitor General Noel Francisco, who's part of Attorney General Jeff Sessions' Justice Department, submitted a brief this week to the U.S. Supreme Court, essentially saying that it's perfectly legal to discriminate against someone on the basis of gender identity. The High Court is considering whether or not to hear a case involving a transgender worker who was fired by a Michigan funeral home. Backed by the anti-queer legal group Alliance Defending Freedom, the funeral home is challenging an appeals court ruling that the firing of trans worker Amy Stevens violated federal law banning workplace bias based on sex. In ruling that trans people are protected by those laws, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit said the funeral home management's religious beliefs about gender were irrelevant. The brief submitted by the Trump administration backs the funeral home's argument that the specific federal law in question, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, banning sex discrimination, does not protect transgender people. Most lower courts have agreed with the Sixth Circuit's interpretation. The Supreme Court is also considering cases testing whether or not lesbian, gay, and bisexual people are also protected by federal laws banning bias based on sex.
The Trump assault on transgender humanity, drawing the most media coverage this week, followed an October 21st New York Times report that the administration was considering policy changes defining gender as unchangeable and based strictly on genitalia at birth.
Trans rights are human rights. Trans rights are human rights.
We will not be erased.
We will not be erased.
The federal government's proposed virtual erasure of transgender people drew a swift challenge from an impressive number of progressive organizations, in addition to the expected lineup of major queer groups. We'll have a lot more on that part of the story later in the program on most of these same This Way Out stations.
Meanwhile, controversial transgender whistleblower Chelsea Manning announced on social media this week that she had undergone long-awaited surgery. She posted a smiling selfie from her hospital bed, but didn't discuss the specifics of the procedure. After almost a decade of fighting, she wrote, through prison, the courts, a hunger strike, and through the insurance company, I finally got the surgery this week. She didn't take any time off from her activism, however, quickly condemning the latest anti-trans moves by the Trump administration. Laws don't determine our existence, she tweeted. We determine our existence.
Britain's House of Commons has waded into the log-jammed effort to establish marriage equality in Northern Ireland, the only major part of the United Kingdom without it. The legislature in heavily Roman Catholic Northern Ireland is dysfunctional due to fractious policy differences between the two major parties, primarily over marriage equality and abortion. Same-gender couples legally married elsewhere are only recognized as civil partners, and women seeking a safe abortion must travel to England for the procedure. Emergency legislation giving Northern Ireland's civil servants more decision-making authority until lawmakers can resolve their differences included an amendment instructing Northern Ireland Secretary Karen Bradley to issue guidance on the continued enforcement by civil servants of laws that outlaw abortion and deny civil marriage to same-gender couples, and to report quarterly to Parliament on those issues. The amendment was sponsored by Labour and Tory MPs and passed in the Commons by a vote of 207 to 117. Human rights activists cheered the action. While mostly symbolic, they say it puts more pressure on Northern Ireland lawmakers to get their house in order, including the passage of marriage equality, a move supported in poll after poll by an overwhelming majority of the people of Northern Ireland. The country's High Court heard a legal challenge to Northern Ireland's unequal marriage laws in September.
A 16-year-old gay activist in Russia unexpectedly won an appeal this week of his conviction of violating the country's infamous law against promoting non-traditional sexual relations after he posted several photos of shirtless men hugging on social media. Maxim Nevrov is believed to be the only suspect under the age of 18 to be charged with that offense since Vladimir Putin signed the so-called No Promo Homo Bill into law in 2013. The teenager's lawyer, Artem Lapov, from the advocacy group Russian LGBT Network, applauded the legal victory. The court used the principle of the presumption of innocence and came to the conclusion that Nevrov's guilt in committing the offense was not proven, he said. On the basis of this, our complaints were satisfied, and the decision of the Commission on Juvenile Affairs was canceled. Activist Nevrov, who some sources say does not identify as LGBTQ, believes that law enforcement started to monitor his activities after he organized an anti-government gay or Putin performance in May. The European Court of Human Rights ruled last year that Russia's No Promo Homo law violates regional treaties, the right to freedom of expression, and of LGBTQ people to not be discriminated against. The Putin government dismissed the decision as unjust. The law has been used across the country to ban the so-called promotion of LGBTQ rights, including pride events and even the display of rainbow flags.
LGBTQ people on the majority Hindu island of Bali thought they were relatively safe in anti-queer, predominantly Muslim Indonesia, where government officials and security police have been leading a steadily escalating series of attacks on sexual and gender-variant minorities. But homophobic Muslim groups pressured the owners of a convention hall in Denpasar, Bali's capital, to cancel a beauty pageant organized by the Gaya Dewata Foundation, an HIV/AIDS prevention and education group. The annual event has been held successfully for the past 3 years. 24 contestants, narrowed down from a field of 80 contenders, all Indonesian, were set to compete in separate Mr. and Miss categories through talent performances and a drag show. All finalists were required to undergo training and demonstrate knowledge of sexual health and HIV issues. A fearful Balinese gay man, who only disclosed his first name, Agung, told The Voice of America that, "I thought Bali would have that space for us to be ourselves. It doesn't have that bubble anymore."
LGBTQ activists and their allies rallied outside Australia's parliament this week, chanting, "Where's the bill?" They were calling on Prime Minister Scott Morrison to make good on his promise, as our Sydney correspondent Barry McKay reported last week, to offer legislation to ban bias against queer students in religious schools. Greens Senator Janet Rice spoke to the rally in Canberra, joined by a few other lawmakers, representatives of the Human Rights Law Center, Rainbow Families, and parents of gender-diverse children, along with some of those children. Rice noted that the current session of Parliament was virtually over. She promised that if it's not at the top of Morrison's legislative agenda in the next session, assuming he's still Prime Minister, her party would do his job for him.
And finally, cigars all around for a pair of Aussie penguin dads at Sydney's Sea Life Aquarium. Caretakers first noticed that Sven and Magic had formed a close bond ahead of breeding season, and that Sven had even offered Magic a special stone, which a staff member explained was equivalent to proposing in the love language of penguins. The penguin partners began hoarding pebbles to build a nest, indicating their desire to start a family. They were given an abandoned egg, and their baby chick hatched this week, initially named Svenjik after its two foster parents. The chick's permanent name will be chosen after its gender is determined in about 2 months. Announcing the news on Facebook, the Aquarium reported that the loving foster parents are co-parenting exceptionally well to raise their young. Same-gender pairings are fairly common among penguins. We love watching the proud parents doting and taking turns caring for their baby chick, the Aquarium Facebook posting gushed. We can't wait for the world to fall in love with baby Svenjik, like they did with our amazing same-sex couple, Sven and Magic.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending October 27th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the always updated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
This just in, a far-right nationalist known as the Trump of the Tropics has been elected president of Brazil. With most of the October 28th votes counted, social liberal Jair Bolsonaro was defeating the Workers' Party's Fernando Haddad 55% to 45%. Bolsonaro has proudly denigrated LGBTQ people, women, and ethnic minorities. Although 29% of queer voters were expected to support Bolsonaro as a reaction against corruption under the Workers' Party government, his election has national LGBTQ and international human rights organizations sounding the alarm. Murders and other hate crimes against LGBTQ Brazilians have skyrocketed during the presidential campaign. Bolsonaro is a fan of both Donald Trump and the brutal military dictatorship that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 1985. In other late-breaking news, the Delta Foundation of Pittsburgh reports that the October 27th mass shooting at a synagogue there took place during a bris for the newly adopted twins of a gay couple. Other sources say that prominent HIV specialist Dr. Jerry Rabinowitz was among the slain. Just how gay is Halloween?
It's time to trick or treat.
You'll find out later in the program. But first, something even more scary and very real.
Stand in the end, you'll still be you. One that's done all the things you set out to do. Stand,
there's a cross for you.
U.S. trans activists responded swiftly and emphatically to the news that the Trump administration was working on a plan to effectively erase transgender people from civil rights law. A draft memo leaked to the New York Times revealed that the Department of Health and Human Services was seeking to get the Departments of Justice, Education, and Labor on board with a unified definition of sex in Title IX of the Civil Rights Act. The Obama administration had pushed to define protections against discrimination based on sex to include gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. This proposed definition says that sex means a person's status as male or female based on immutable biological traits identifiable by or before birth, and that the sex listed on a person's birth certificate as originally issued shall constitute definitive proof of a person's sex unless rebutted by reliable genetic evidence. Protests erupted as soon as the Times published its piece on October 21st, and the pictures of trans people with the hashtag won't be erased flooded social media. A coalition of organizations held a press conference at the Human Rights Campaign the following morning.
I am Mara Kiesman from the National Center for Transgender Equality, and I am livid, but clear-headed. And I want to tell you what is going on right now. I want to tell you how people are feeling right now. When I look at my social media feed, when I look at my emails from scared parents, when I get phone calls from trans people who just are terrified of this administration, I know that once again they have gone too far, and that's important. Once again they have gone too far. We are we are scared as trans people. What they are doing, to put this in the simplest of terms, is this is the federal government saying, we will not enforce federal civil rights laws, laws that I am entitled to have enforced, laws that Congress has said they have to enforce, laws that were duly passed and have gone through all sorts of judicial hoops to be interpreted the way they are currently interpreted. Trans people are extraordinary people. Trans people will sometimes tell you that we're ordinary people, and they mean we have to pay our rent, we have to eat food. But I will tell you, ordinary people don't really look at who they are and know that they're going to be that and do that, knowing that they can lose their families, their health care, their school, their job. That is an extraordinary person. And extraordinary people stand up and are resilient, and trans people have proven that over and over again. And we will stand up, we will be resilient, and we will be here long after this administration is in the trash heap. I am so proud to be here with so many allied organizations, so many trans people, so many not trans people. We're ready. We're standing up. We're fighting back. And we will stand together, fight together, and I guarantee you we will win together.
I'm Fatima Goss-Graves. I'm president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center. And we're here today because, once again, this administration is seeking to institutionalize hate. The Trump administration may believe that it can rewrite rules so that transgender people are no longer in the law. It certainly cannot write trans people out of existence. They will not be erased. None of us will let that happen. And so my main message today is to the many transgender patients and students and workers and anyone hearing this news that we see you, we support you, and we will not back down. Fear and ignorance really have no place in determining national policy, and we are committed to coming together with the entire community to be sure that this initiative never sees the light of day.
My name is Angela Farrell Zabala, and I am here representing Planned Parenthood Action Fund and the nearly 2.5 million patients who come to Planned Parenthood health centers every year. Planned Parenthood denounces the Trump-Pence administration's cruel and discriminatory action to erase civil rights protections for transgender people. Planned Parenthood is proud to provide quality, compassionate health care to transgender men, women, and adolescents, and to gender nonconforming people. Our services and programs are open to people of all gender identities and sexual orientations. We know that transgender people, especially transgender women of color, often carry the heaviest burdens. Studies show that 1/3 of transgender people have had at least one negative experience with a healthcare provider in the past year. And nearly 1/4 of transgender people report not seeing a doctor when they needed to because of fear of being mistreated. Transgender people exist and will not be erased. They already face extreme burdens to get the basic care they need to build their lives. This policy from the Trump administration would only add to their burdens. Every person, no matter their gender, identity, sex, or sexual orientation, deserves the right to freedom and equality under the law. We will not accept anything less.
My name is Laura Durso. I'm the Vice President of the LGBT Research and Communications Project at the Center for American Progress. It's really a privilege to join all of my dear colleagues. And it's a privilege to do the work that we do. My job is to make sure that the progressive movement represents and meets the needs of LGBTQ people nationwide. And so gone are the days when opponents of equality could get away with their discriminatory agenda because good people either didn't know what to say or didn't have the courage to say it. So I'm here to say that CAP stands with you in full-throated support of our transgender siblings and of all people whose gender doesn't fit some preconceived notion of who people should be or what they should look like. I don't know who they thought they were fooling before, but they are finally not trying to hide what we've known since the beginning, that Donald Trump and Mike Pence are determined to harm LGBTQ communities because to them, we are less than people, and harming us helps them score political points. Transgender people will not be erased. LGBTQ people are not going to be pushed into the shadows. And 2 weeks from tomorrow, we need to get everyone out to the polls to tell this administration that we have had enough.
My name is Soraya Lester. I'm the conference's coordinator in MAC, and I am proud to be a transgender woman of color. I'm proud to be a godmother, a daughter, a child, an aunt, a grandchild, a friend. What I am not is a cartoon character that can be erased. Because of my gender identity, I've been largely invisible to the powers that be in this country. I've been disregarded, disrespected, disenfranchised, and treated like I don't exist. And now, this administration wants to make that invisibility official policy. No words, no action can erase me, and those who stand here with me as well. We must end willful ignorance in this country. We must end the use of bigotry to frame government policy. And what we must do is embrace all the colors of humanity.
Ariah Lester of the Minority AIDS Council and the others were just a few of the speakers at the press conference. There were also representatives from the National LGBTQ Task Force, Lambda Legal, Freedom for All Americans, PFLAG National, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and the ACLU. The president himself responded to the controversy 2 days after the draft memo was exposed.
We're looking at it.
When he was caught by reporters near his helicopter pad en route to a midterm campaign rally, Trump replied with his usual incisive grasp of policy development.
We have a lot of different concepts right now. They have a lot of different things happening with respect to transgender right now. You know that as well as I do, and we're looking at it very seriously. I'm protecting everybody. You know what I'm doing? I'm protecting everybody. I want to protect our country.
Chase Strangio is a staff attorney with the ACLU LGBT and HIV Project.
The executive branch of government cannot single-handedly change the law.
A trans man himself, Strangio put the Health and Human Services effort to write out transgender protections into perspective with Amy Goodman on Democracy Now!
This is an effort to narrow federal civil rights protections, but federal civil rights protections are still written by Congress, existing in federal law, and interpreted by the court. So this is certainly not the final word on anything, but it is part of a widespread attack on the trans community that we've seen across the administration. And this is also what fuels violence against so many trans people, especially trans people of color.
Because
there's this idea that trans people are inauthentic, that we're out here to deceive you. But the reality is that we are who we say we are, and that biological sex, as the other side, as the right, as people in power in the Trump administration are trying to talk about it, is not a scientific fact. It's an ideological effort to tell people that trans existence isn't real. And the more we have an ideological debate about whether or not it's, you know, moral or ethical to recognize the existence of trans people, the more we're going to embolden the Trump administration and other state-level government actors to act to take away our rights. This isn't a debate. It doesn't violate anyone else's rights for trans people to have rights.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights.
The ACLU has vowed prompt legal action against any attempt to put the proposed anti-transgender definition into effect, and clearly many others are ready to fight. Among them is popular television psychologist Dr. Phil McGraw, who offered his terse analysis on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
That's the absolute height of arrogance. Where does that come from? You think just I'm going to change the word, I'm going to take that out of the dictionary, and these people seek to exist? Kiss my ass. You can't do that. Really?
It's Halloween, and you can cower in fear or come out and be queer with This Way Out Music Focus host Steve Sims, who aims to see Samhain songs rival Christmas carols in the holiday tune tournament.
Oh, 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 listen to the music. Oh, oh, listen to the music. Oh, oh.
Some call it the Gay High Holy Day. Lesbian poet Judy Grand called it the Great Gay Holiday. Others simply refer to it as Our Night.
It's Halloween. It's Halloween. So get your scary costume on and come with me.
It's time to trick or treat.
Pumpkin patch, going to the pumpkin patch. Gonna snatch a big old batch, pumpkins down at the pumpkin patch.
Yes, Halloween. You can be anyone on Halloween. You can express yourself, your gender, your sexuality, in any way you see fit. You can be good or evil.
Pick a costume, make it work. Just don't be a jerk.
If you've ever melted chocolate for a human fondue, you've discovered that it's harder to remove than Elmer's glue.
Black, black heart.
Ralph Lee kicked off the first Village Halloween parade in New York City in 1974. That celebration has since become the largest Halloween parade in the world, and it still attracts the most elaborate handmade costumes you can find south of Broadway.
The people cheered as they gamely prayed at the Mermaid Parade.
Rock music history is peppered with sinister spookiness that can be repurposed for Halloween.
What's in your head? In your head, zombie, zombie, zombie.
I'm on the highway to hell. On the highway to hell.
When I die and they leave me the rest, gonna go to the place that's the best.
Religious have Christmas, but as queer folk, we have All Hallows' Eve. When it comes to music, it seems you can find a Halloween song almost anywhere if you listen close enough. It can pop out of literature, the movie screen, or stage, from Lemony and Rocky to Elphaba and Glinda.
Scream, 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 and run away.
I knew you. I have been changed for good.
Over the last 40 years, we have shaped October 31st into the quintessential LGBT holiday, and it only gets gayer with age. All of the music in this segment are by LGBT artists. You can find more about the songs at questoflife.org. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Oh, my pumpkin horse is smiling and I want it to look real mean, like me.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Sarah Sweeney, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Sly and the Family Stone and Bob Marley performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Thanks for helping to keep our 30-year streak going at thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on CJSF Burnaby, British Columbia, KUGS Bellingham, Washington, 4BI Fortitude Valley, Queensland, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 18 years have elapsed since Michael Hart and Antonio Negri published a major work of political theory called Empire. That book, together with the two that followed, with the titles Multitude and Commonwealth, formed what's called the Empire Trilogy. Then came the volume Declaration, published in 2012, and last year saw the arrival of Hart and Negri's latest foray into debates over what social movements and the left can accomplish in the face of current systems of domination. That foray, that book, has the title Assembly. Michael Hart is a political philosopher and professor of literature based at Duke University. He also co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. When Michael joined me from a studio on the Duke campus, he began with these remarks about what prompted the writing of Assembly.
Well, this book project starts for me and Tony really with 2011, and both the enthusiasm for a variety of movements across the world, and then starting with the Arab Spring, Tunisia and Egypt, moving to Spain and Greece, finally arriving across the Atlantic with Zuccotti Park and the various forms of Occupy. And we felt like these movements were inspiring for many people, in fact, expressed the desires and aspirations for democracy of so many people, and yet we're not able to transform our societies in a more just and democratic direction. So that for us already poses a conundrum about organization and leadership, because precisely all of these movements in 2011 are called at least leaderless movements. They're in fact experimenting with new forms of organization. So that at least is an initial inspiration for us, or a need for us, it seems, to rethink questions about organization and leadership.
What did you see going on within the movements you mentioned in terms of discussions around leadership and decision making?
Well, it seemed to us that within the movements themselves, there seemed to be a false choice after 2011, or you could say after 2013, because certainly Gezi Park movement is part of this. Even continuing on further, I would say that the various parts of Black Lives Matter movements, in fact, go under this too. I think within the movements, there's been a false choice between a pure horizontalism, that is a refusal of leadership and really institutional structures in all forms, or a return to older traditional forms of centralization and leadership, often in the form of some sort of party or vanguard party. And it seems to us that that's not really the choice. In that sense, the conundrum of either leaderlessness or an old-fashioned centralized form of leadership, that's what seemed to us a conundrum that had to be addressed.
Leaders of movements, when movements have leaders, are thought to have the unique ability to do the strategic planning required to advance the movement's goals. What's your take on this?
Exactly. I think we have to recognize the roles that leaders have played in revolutionary movements in the past. Leaders, single charismatic leaders, but also central committees, leadership structures, etc., to recognize the roles they have played, like you say, most importantly, even for strategic planning, for decision making, and recognize how we could accomplish them otherwise. So this doesn't seem to us a refusal of leadership as such, but mechanisms for accomplishing what leadership structures have done in the past, and accomplishing that in a different way. So, for instance, both the ability to make political decisions, but also the ability to institutionalize, to make last of movement. These are at least two of the characteristics that leadership structures have been responsible for in the past.
Is there a concern on your and Antonio Negri's part that leaders, when they do strategy, when they are entrusted to do strategy or just do strategy, that there's a danger involved there, that there's something that is taken away from the masses, from the movements?
I would say that at least the last 50 years, in a variety of countries, the U.S. and really every national context, there has been a questioning, an undermining of the undemocratic nature of leadership structures. Think of it, here would be the most easily accessed example, I think, when the U.S. is think about various practices within feminist movements in the 1970s and 1980s, the insistence that everyone speaks at a meeting in various consciousness-raising formats, the refusal to allow people to speak to the media in the name of the group. These are all practices that are trying to undermine the undemocratic nature of centralized leadership structures. I think that's also gone on in anti-racist struggles, in student movements, in labor movements, in a whole variety of struggles, this questioning and even undermining of the structures of the centralized and hence undemocratic forms of leadership. So I think we have to build on and learn from where the movements are. I mean, here's another way of looking at it, if you like. This seems like a perfectly realist way of saying it, which is the movements social movements as they are today, have created a kind of allergy to leadership structures. They're really constituted in such a way that leadership structures in their traditional form really can't take hold. So for better or for worse, you know, there are these antibodies floating around that are going to attack any leadership structure that evolves. So it seems to me not even a viable option, just being realistic, that one could try to impose traditional centralized leadership structures on the movements. What one has to do instead, this is the only realistic option, it seems to me, is to try to develop forms of organization and institution that accomplish what traditional leadership structures have done, but do it in a democratic form. That's really what I think is required.
So what are you and Mr. Negri arguing in terms of how responsibility should be allocated, ideally, between leadership structures and movements. Because you still do want, quote, leaders in some sense. You want them to do certain things. So what do you feel comfortable leaders doing and the movements in general doing?
The way Tony and I think of it is, and not as an answer, this is not a solution, this is a framework for thinking about a solution, is that there has to be an inversion of strategy and tactics, in the sense that, as you were already saying, that the traditional format in revolutionary movements and various forms of liberation movements has been that leaders have been given the responsibility of strategy, thinking in the long term, making decisions over the most important issues, seeing far, understanding the entire social field. That's strategy, and leaders have been responsible for that. Whereas the people themselves, the movement, have been responsible for tactics, localized actions, even localized decision making. What we think needs to happen is an inversion of that. That there still should be structures for leadership. There are times when we do need decisions made in a short term. Some decisions require expertise. These are things that leaders should be assigned. You know, here's the stupidest example or the easiest example. You know, any good demonstration requires that you have certain people that are not only responsible for security, but that can monitor to figure where the police have blocked off this street and we need to turn on this street, or how to stop people from being arrested, or how to get people out of jail once they are arrested. I mean, these seem to us like a kind of tactical leadership that can be assigned and dismissed for temporary means. And this is the much harder part. Whereas the multitude or the people or the movement themselves in a democratic way have to be responsible for strategy. Like I said, for making decisions over the most important questions, for making long-term plans, for assuring continuity. That's a much harder question. In fact, I would say that the majority of the book is our trying to understand and even test that the multitude could be capable of strategy. How is it that people can decide democratically over the most important political questions? How are we going to be capable of that? That's really our question. That seems to me the most important question that arises from this thinking about organization.
So Multitude, which was the name of one of your earlier books, part of the Empire Trilogy, Multitude is a word with a very specific meaning in that book. You've referred to the multitude, the movements, the people. Are you kind of bringing them all together, those terms, or is there something about the multitude which you are suggesting in this book, Assembly, is kind of the entity, the population out of which will emerge this strategy to confront the status quo? Are you saying that the multitude specifically has a role? So I guess I'm wondering what the multitude is and how to differentiate that from the masses.
Sometimes casually I use them interchangeably, the people, the movement, the multitude, the masses. But that's really only to try to just communicate with people where they are with the terms they use. Tony and I do understand multitude in a relatively specific way. But I think one that is pretty easily understand with where other people are, what we're really trying to designate is a population in struggle that includes real differences. So that would be the contrast to the notion of the people. The people is often, at least, thought of as a unity and even relatively homogeneous. Or rather, the notion of the people itself starts to function like an identity. We want rather, and it seems to us important rather, to emphasize the real differences that exist within the people in struggle, and to insist nonetheless that we can struggle together, that we can struggle in common. You know, so here's one way to approach it, if this is a vocabulary that works for you. You know, we were inspired at a certain point and learned a great deal at a certain point from the concept of intersectionality that comes really through a Black feminist, U.S. Black feminist origin, and then has become extremely important concept within women's studies and feminist studies. And part of what it does, I guess it's really twofold, is one is to emphasize the radical plurality of differences. Often, I suppose, in identity terms. And then the other side is the possibility or the need for coalition, you know, for a political struggle to be to recognize those differences and then to pose coalition. For instance, the Combahee River Collective statement was one original point of that, let's say. So that's one way of approaching what multitude should be, is through that notion of coalition. The hesitation should be, but this is also a discussion within those who use the term intersectionality too, is that for us, multitude shouldn't be thought of as just a set of identities that then have external relations to one another. And that's the caution with any notion about coalition. But rather, multitude is a way that we can, like we would put it, I hope this can make sense, as a set of becomings, like that all of these differences are also becoming different and becoming different in struggle together. So it's not a model, I guess this is the basic thing. It's not a model that we have to be unified in order to be strong. You know, we don't have to say we're all after one thing. We all don't say we are the same, but it's finding ways to recognize the social multiplicity, social plurality, if you like, but that can nonetheless struggle in common. That's what's important to us about the concept of multitude. And I think if you look at all of the social movements around us, is really crucial and basic for activists in practice.
Michael Hart joins us on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. He teaches at Duke University, and we are talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain. Okay, so if leadership should do tactics and movements, or the multitude should do strategy, then the question is, and you posed it a bit earlier this hour, is can the multitude do strategy? How will the multitude do strategy? And this is a big discussion. It occupies a large portion of this book, Assembly. But maybe we could start with what you stress in this book about cooperation and social cooperation and existing circuits of cooperation, already existing circuits, amongst the multitude. So can we start there? Like, what do you see as kind of bringing the multitude together, despite the fact that they live in different places, they have different employers, some people don't work or can't work? What's the kind of cooperation from which you draw some encouragement?
In many senses, this question, is the multitude capable of strategy? It really overlaps strongly with a maybe more familiar question, which is, are people really capable of democracy? In other words, I don't mean, you know, can they go out and vote in elections every once in a while? What I mean is, can people collectively govern themselves, collectively make political decisions? And that's that too, it's just another way of posing what is really a quite difficult question. You have to ask what are people's capacities in their daily lives? I mean, I don't think anyone should assume that people are born and spontaneously have the ability to collectively govern themselves, to make political decisions together. So for Tony and I, looking at people's capacities in their daily lives, for Tony and I, it does pass through an economic register, you know, through labor, but labor thought quite broadly. It's not just what people do at work, you know, like what people do for a wage. We think labor or really social production in a quite expanded frame, like how people produce social value in cooperation with each other. And in fact, it's those circuits of cooperation in social production that seem to us one key for recognizing people's capacities for political self-rule, you know, for collective decision-making. So that leads us through quite extensive, I guess, economic analysis about capital today, how capital today primarily extracts values that are produced socially, and that analyzing the way that people produce value socially that capital subsequently extracts, that gives us a key or a lens through which to recognize people's capacities for, you know, like I say, when we say that for people cooperating together, creating new circuits of cooperation and social production, strongly overlaps with their capacities for making political decisions together.
Financial mechanisms and finance, you argue, are employed, are being employed, have been deployed more and more by the bosses, the capitalist bosses. What impact has that had on the relationship between capitalist mechanisms of command and workers, with that term construed broadly?
Yeah, big question. But let me actually start back. I hope I can do this quickly enough for it to make sense for us. I would say, or Tony and I start from an hypothesis in a way that capital functions primarily today through extraction, through extracting values that are produced elsewhere. So you could start by thinking, and many authors do, Tony and I started this thinking with scholars and activists in Argentina, that capital functions today in large part through the extraction of oil, of minerals, even thinking of monocultural agriculture as a kind of extraction of wealth that it finds seemingly free for the taking, an old colonialist imaginary, and extracts them from the earth. Well, in the same way, it seems to us, capital functions by extracting social values. Like, as a kind of hinge, think about the metaphor of data mining. Data mining is seemingly the same kind of extraction, like the kind of mining. Data might even sound inert, you know, the kind of data mining that Facebook does or that social media that functions through social media, et cetera. What they are, you know, data sounds inert, like it's just, I don't know, your age and height or something like that. But actually what's getting mined are forms of intelligence, social relations, things, forms of social wealth that are being produced, you know, often on social media by users, et cetera. So that might give you a key to thinking about how capital functions, say, in platform capitalism, you know, like in social media and various similar forms, Uber, capital functions not by producing values the way it did in the factory. In other words, by organizing cooperation itself. That's the way capital functioned in the factory. But rather by extracting values that are produced by relatively autonomous social cooperation. Like, that's where we're going with this. So finance, to come back to that question, finance might be at the end of that entire line of reasoning, that finance functions, at least in large part, as a mechanism to extract values, extract and accumulate values that are produced socially outside of its direct organization. I hope that sequence made some sense.
Yeah, it does. And so when you said outside of its direct organization, are you saying that a gap has opened between finance and capitalists more generally and workers, or maybe that gap has widened in recent years?
I think it's definitely widened, but start already with the early 20th century readings of finance capital, Rudolf Hilferding, Lenin himself. One thing they posed is they were thinking of this in spatial terms, that what finance represents is a distance between the banker, the holder of financial capital, and the organization of production. So the values were being produced in the industrial context for them, early 20th century, but the profits were being accumulated at a distance by the banker. That's a similar thing. You could say that that gap, like you were just pointing out exactly, that that's a gap, and that gap perhaps has widened. So there are two things you could also react about that gap. On the one hand, you could be outraged, indignant at the injustice. Yes, of course. But the second thing you might think about is, at least in the context of social production, that there is a certain potential, certainly not automatic, but a potential for autonomy that's marked by that gap. I'm talking in somewhat abstract metaphorical terms here, but I hope it makes sense, because what we want to say, here's another way of getting at the same question. When Marx is writing mid-19th century about industrial production, when he talks about cooperation, for those Marxologists in the room, chapter 13 of volume 1 of Capital. When he talks about cooperation, it's the one time in the book where the capitalist has a intrinsic role. The capitalist is not a parasite, because what the capitalist is necessary for is to institute and organize cooperation, creating the site for the workers to cooperate, bringing them together, even disciplining them, forcing them to cooperate, giving them the mechanisms to cooperate, etc. So in some ways, cooperation in that context comes from above. I would say that by and large in social cooperation today, the kind of social cooperation, the values of which are extracted by finance capital or by platform capital for finance through platform capital, cooperation primarily arises from below. And that's actually, I think, an important difference, or at least my metaphor of above and below give an idea of a possibility that could look outside of and beyond capital that is intrinsic in these forms of cooperation.
I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Hart is professor of literature and a political philosopher based at Duke University. He's co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy, consisting of the volumes Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. The two have also authored the book Declaration, and their latest book is Assembly. You and Antonio Negri are also interested in the kinds of knowledges that workers have access to, and in some case, the knowledges built up, let's say in relationship to machines and machine systems, that the knowledge about these things that workers have built up that may actually exceed what the bosses, what the capitalists actually have. Can you talk about that and also talk about what resources those knowledges might have for this project of developing a strategy among the multitude, by the multitude?
That's great. I think you're right that we should, one could thematize, and one should do this in many frameworks, that those below have superior knowledge. So the instance you were just mentioning is, and this has long been part of the arguments for self-management, you know, in the various self-management movements of factories in the course of the 20th century, which is that the workers do know how everything works, how to make everything. The engineer doesn't even know, and certainly the factory owner or the bosses don't know. They actually know how everything goes together in the car and how everything is made, et cetera. They have a superior knowledge, like you're saying. I mean, what do you do then with that recognition that from below one has a superior knowledge? I think that that knowledge has to be mobilized. I mean, that knowledge has to be mobilized and organized. But it's an important first recognition, because I think that that our assumptions against the possibility of democracy, the assumptions against the possibility that the multitude could be capable of making decisions for a better society are so strong that it's helpful to have recognitions like that that show us the capacities that could be organized.
And I think could is the key word here, right? Because despite the fact that there are, as you say, already existing circuits of cooperation among the multitude, despite the fact that labor, if we agree with you, has achieved a certain kind of autonomy in relationship to the capitalist class, or despite the fact that workers do have more intimate knowledges of, you know, what they're working with and what they're making than the people who oversee their activities, the question is how that all comes together such that the multitude acts in a kind of a unified way, despite their differences, to actually produce strategy that can move a political project of social and political transformation, fundamental transformation, forward.
You're exactly right. And it's important with how you're emphasizing the could, because there's nothing spontaneous about this. There's nothing immediate about this. There's nothing guaranteed about this. It requires organization. But let me try another example that might just simplify these things, because I think it doesn't have to be – I keep posing it at a large scale, and it might be good to start with some smaller scales. I remember being told by friends about a vote in Berlin, in the city of Berlin, a municipal vote some years ago about the electrical system. And the vote was whether to make the electric system common. So what they meant by that was, you know, pre-1989, the electric system was state-run, both east and west in Berlin. So it was public property, you know, property of the state. After 1989, the electric system was private, both east and west. In other words, like in many of the U.S. municipalities, it was electric system was run by private corporations. If we were to make it common, it would mean that the residents of Berlin would make be able to make decisions about the most important aspects of it. Like, it's not like all residents of Berlin are electrical engineers. They, of course, don't know all the specifics about, you know, whatever, circuits, etc. But they know enough, and they certainly could know enough, to make decisions like, should we use nuclear energy or not? What should the pricing scales be? Should there be variable pricing for the rich and the poor? Like, these are the kinds of decisions that we could be capable of making. So that's the it's a good example, I think, because it both touches on the common, which is maybe something worth talking about. But it also shows that, you know, of course, there are certain things that certain expertise, you could call it leadership in that sense, is required for. But the really important decisions, what earlier we were talking about in terms of strategy, those really important decisions don't require any greater expertise than everyone could easily attain. And that they're really political decisions about how we, what kind of society we want. And that's the kind of thing that we can and really should develop the capacity to decide together.
Let me ask you about the common. How important is the common to you and Antonio Negri? And, you know, when people think about the commons, they think about private property being turned into something else, turned into often public property. Is the common equivalent in your analysis to public property?
Tony and I differentiate the common, well, first from private property, but also from public property, which by public property, we really mean property that is controlled by the state. So there is, of course, greater access to public property. But in that final analysis, it's really the state that decides over it, not us. I mean, what's crucial, I would say, in all of these questions about property and the common is are really two factors. One is who has access, and the other is who decides. Private property is primarily characterized, even though in first-year law school courses they put it in a more sophisticated way, but I think in our vernacular, our normal way of thinking about it, private property primarily consists of the fact that there's limited access and that there's a monopoly over decision-making. That's what it means to be the owner of something. Public property, in essence, has the access is really controlled by, and the decision-making is controlled by, the state. What we want is something different, or what we think of as the common is something different, which would be an open access and democratic mechanisms of decision-making over the use, for instance, the use of a field, or the use of cultural products like music, or, you know, variety of other both material and immaterial goods, you know, the use of code. To make it common would mean that you open the access and then have some democratic structure for making decisions about it. That's what we understand by the common.
Right. And so if there is to be some kind of decision making, some kind of collective decision making to manage the common and our access to the common, then we need some kind of institutions. And I wonder if you believe that kind of the existing kinds of institutions we see in capitalist society fit the bill, or something more innovative and kind of more appropriate to the kinds of governance we want to establish is in order.
My instinct is often to start with social movements that are and think about institutions from there. Like, there are several social movements today. In fact, I would say it's a guiding thread in many of the most inspiring social movements today that are demanding the common, even without using that terminology. For instance, the Standing Rock protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline, they were super important in a lot of ways. The extraordinary gathering of North American tribes, the ways that environmentalists followed the lead of indigenous populations. But what really most interests me is that the objection to the pipeline was not in terms of property. You can imagine a property argument, you know, even a property argument that includes the violation of various treaties for the tribes. But it was not that, you know, you can't put this pipeline through because it's going to destroy our property, it's going to destroy our water. No, what the water protectors, some of the leaders at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests were saying at Standing Rock was that we need to regard the earth differently. In effect, we really need to regard the earth as common, not as property. Like, we need to establish a relationship of care and responsibility with the earth. It seems like the kind of thing I learned from, because, you know, they have a notion of the common in that statement in itself that goes far beyond what Tony and I were imagining, but at least gives you kind of an idea about an argument, a movement that's demanding the common and refusing the logics of private property. And then you would have to organize it. That's what, in fact, that's what you're asking me for, is what would be the institutions that could follow on that and organize the decision-making structures required for the common. You know, here's what Tony and I say as a guide. One thing we propose as a guide is these have to be non-sovereign institutions. By non-sovereign, we don't mean not autonomous. We mean not belonging to traditions of sovereignty, which would be having to do with centralized decision-making and structures of authority, that we need to invent new institutions that can be properly democratic. That's the, in some ways, the question of the common and the question of the organization of democracy completely overlap with one another. And I guess with this too, it'd be tempting, or in such discussions, it's always tempting to ask someone, you know, like, well, how would you do this? What would you do? And one should resist. I think what the kind of theorizing that Tony and I do can contribute are kind of guidelines, conceptual guidelines. I think for the real content of it, that's why my instinct is to go to the movements. I think for the real content of it, you have to look at the kinds of practices and even institutions that people are already developing. I mean, this all goes under the motto of when someone asks you what is to be done, your first response should be, what are people already doing? And like, if you start with what people are already doing, it probably gets you much further than starting with the what is to be done.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. We're talking about his latest book, co-authored with Antonio Negri. It's called Assembly. It's published by Oxford University Press. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Michael about his book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Hart is based at Duke University. He's a political philosopher and a professor of literature. He co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. And we are discussing his book, co-authored with Antonio Negri, called Assembly. Before we go on to talk about kind of concrete paths toward the new forms of governance that you advocate for in this book, I do want to kind of bring up an argument. I know it's kind of an old one, but I think listeners might be thinking along the lines of, what about kind of dead-end, low-wage workers, right? Because part of what you're doing is to emphasize the rise of cognitive labor, right? Sort of labor that is has a certain kind of expertise in relation to machines and machine systems, digitalization, communication technologies. A lot of these people are, a lot of workers are immiserated and are working in very difficult, menial jobs that doesn't allow, perhaps, and maybe you could tell me otherwise, doesn't allow for the kind of social cooperation and social production that you and Antonio Negri emphasize. So how do we think about those people not just being part of the multitude, but being part of the productive capacities, subversive capacities of the multitude as part of our group that can help strategize toward a better future?
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, I think first, and one should add to what you're saying too, that, you know, even in the various high-tech communications industries, for every, you know, for every software programmer, there's 100 people doing click work in a room of just, you know, entering data, et cetera. So it's not as if any of these jobs are any of these jobs are a guarantee of some sort of revolutionary capacity. I think it's important. That's two things I would say as starting points. Tony and I have resisted many of our friends, and this was starting with friends of ours in France, that were focused on recognizing the new forms of labor in terms of, you know, what they were calling cognitive labor, the formation of a cognitariat. And what we were resisting is that new forms of labor, you know, moving out of industrial assembly line, were involved just with the questions of intelligence. You know, so what we, one of the things that seemed to us to important to add to that is to also focus on affective forms of labor, which of course has a strong gendered component. You know, if one thinks about the kinds of affective labor in various of form, you know, kinds of labor that involve service, you know, flight attendants was a classic example, but it's also true, I suppose, in education, variety of waiting tables, you know, forms of work that involve, yeah, here we say construction of affects, you might call it emotional work, where a primary part of the job is actually managing people's affective lives. You know, that's what you do when you wait tables. Or what do flight attendants do? They actually have to be nice to people who are jerks to them. Or they sell a kind of friendship, something like that. If one thinks about also that, just a first move of thinking about affective work, in addition to what you were talking about, the cognitive notion, you know, the intellectual notion, it broadens out quite a bit. And you recognize that there, too, there's a great deal of expertise, I guess, but really it's not expertise I'm after so much. There's a great deal of already constructed networks of social cooperation. Like, that's what's going on. You know, think of, for instance, the hospice worker. You know, so the hospice worker working with someone during the last 6 months of their life. And this is also very gendered form of work. But what does that work involve? I mean, of course, there are a lot of material tasks about tending to the wounds and measuring out medication. But a large part of the work, well, is helping someone die, an amazing affective work, but also managing the networks of, you know, the family networks, or the friendship networks of the dying person. Like, this is an extraordinary capacity. Yeah, so if we would think about, you know, earlier we were talking about the pride of the industrial auto worker, that the workers themselves know how the entire system works. Here, too, this is an incredible knowledge of the ability to construct social networks. I mean, this is not some image of liberation. In some ways, it's more horrible when your abilities to love or your abilities to create affects are done for a wage. I mean, that's it might be worse. It might be more exploitative. I'm not saying that. But it's an enormous capacity. That's where I want. And it's in a capacity that involves the construction of networks of social cooperation. So that's one enlargement, it seems to me, not just the cognitive, but also the affective. But the other is that we should also enlarge the notion of labor or the production of value from the wage scene to also unwaged scenes of reproductive labor in the home, but also the kinds of constructions of community that happen all the time and that also involve the kinds of production of value that capital manages to capture, to extract. So if one expands it in that way, it's true, of course. I mean, I'm not singing the praises of, you know, working at 7-Eleven, like, by all means. But I do think it's important to recognize in the ways that a lot of people produce social values, even social values that are able to be captured by capital, how that involves the construction of social networks or, as we were talking about earlier, the production of circuits of cooperation. That's what, I mean, in some ways we're looking for that. I mean, it's true that some people are isolated and don't communicate with others and don't work with others in any way. I wouldn't deny that's true. But one shouldn't neglect the variety of ways that people at the paid work and also in other parts of their life construct these extraordinary social networks of cooperation. And that's what we're looking at.
There are a variety of paths that you and Antonio Negri see that potentially could lead toward a better future and a more sane and humane and just society. And since we don't have a lot of time left, I'm going to summarize each one of them. The first path that you list is called Exodus. It's withdrawing from dominant institutions and creating or trying to create an alternative outside them. And you point to prefigurative politics as an important example of this. The second is reformism, but not just reformism, antagonistic reformism, which is has as its goal a fundamental transformation of power. It's not just like tinkering around the edges and making things better for a few people. And the third path is taking power, kind of taking over and creating the institutions of a new society. And as you have said earlier, you think these institutions need to be new, non-sovereign institutions, not in the mold of institutions that have grown up and developed around sovereign forms of power. So which of these paths make the most sense to you? You don't outright reject any of them, although I could see, and I think our listeners could see that, you know, there are some contradiction. Like if you took all three or you kind of went down all three paths at the same time, there would be a bit of confusion and a lot of fragmentation. So can you share with us what path you see makes the most sense or what combination of paths make the most sense?
Tony and I are taking for granted that, you know, that readers and activists of various sorts will recognize these three. You know, they seem to us as three primary strategies that we've inherited from the movements of recent decades, and that people will not only recognize the three, but also recognize the limitations of each. You know, that of prefigurative politics, the way they sometimes, first of all, don't last. Also, it's difficult to live in that prefigurative world while in the larger society, that it comes to be drowned by the whole. This notion of antagonistic reformism, you know, which sometimes goes by the slogan of the long march through the institutions. It seems often people enter the institutions and get lost in that long march and never end up transforming them. And the third, taking power, it often ends up, you know, with a change of personnel, but the similar structures of power. So I think it does. I mean, while criticizing each of them, you could criticize each of them and say, well, OK, that's it. There's no hope. You know, we're done. I think for Tony and I, it is more like you suggested, that it only makes sense to us to think about these in conjunction. And I don't think it has to be fragmented. Like, let me give you this is a theoretical example. I probably should give you a practical one, too, but it's a theoretical one that's dear to me. So Gilles Deleuze, French philosopher I've been very fond of, he did this beautiful video documentary in which the interviewer went through the alphabet and for each letter gave him a concept that then he was supposed to respond to in French. The interviewer got to G, letter G, and gave him the concept gauche meaning left in French. And Deleuze, the philosopher, immediately responds, there is no such thing as a government of the left. What there can be is a government that gives space to the left. And I love this idea because it does give some sense of that combination, like that I think it makes sense today to take power only insofar as that power makes space available for new prefigurative experiments and is opening itself to the kinds of even antagonistic reformism within itself. So that taking power in a way of what we're calling the sovereign mold really doesn't seem to us like a path. And neither is the path, yeah, like I said, either the other two alone. But the means of working in some ways simultaneously through these three strategies seems to me to make sense. So here's a practical example. At least it in parts corresponds. I have been, and I'm sure many other listeners have been, inspired by the municipal government in Barcelona in Spain. And one of the nice things about the Barcelona en Comú is the name of the party. And one of the nice things is that it really did evolve out of the movements beginning in 2011. In some ways, the evolution of the movements, the evolution of demands of the movements came up to this electoral experiment. But it was an electoral experiment, you know, of a party that was elected in power to run the city. It was an electoral experiment that wasn't a negation of the movements. It wasn't like, you know, okay, now we have a party, you all can go home, we'll take care of things from now on. No, it's rather one that works in conjunction with the movement still existing, often in antagonistic ways. So that seems to me a practical example of thinking some conjunction among these different strategies. Yeah, that might, you know, that may, when we were first talking about them, maybe they could seem, at first glance, they could seem mutually exclusive, you know, or contradictory with one another. And that's what I'm trying to work through, you know, maybe not completely coherently, but I'm trying to work through the ways in which they can be not only compatible, but mutually reinforcing.
One thing that brings a lot of people together is general strikes. How important is a general strike or the weapon of the general strike to the possible revival of the left?
I've been super inspired in the last year by a movement that I know mostly from Argentina, but that exists for many other places in Latin America and in Italy, in Argentina, called Ni Una Menos, literally not one less, but meaning like not one more should die. It's really starting against femicides and against sexual violence. And one of the things, so it's been a mass movement against that in Argentina, you know, sometimes around March 8th, International Women's Day, but also in other things. And one of the practices of Ni Una Menos, of this movement in Argentina, is to try to reinvent the strike, the concept of strike. And really what they've been doing in feminist collectives in different parts of society is say, what does it mean to you to strike? Like, so there's certain worker collectives of women that, you know, to what it means to them to strike is easily recognizable in the classical sense, you know, stop the workplace, stop the point of production. But there are a lot of other feminist collectives that aren't on the factory floor and are not even organized around a workplace, but they are innovating what it means to strike at a social level, you know, to stop the city, to stop the functioning of normal forms of power. Like that's what I think, that's a really important innovation. So in their case, I guess I would say either they're transforming, you know, shifting the question there about general strike, or maybe rather interpreting what general strike means in terms of social strike. Like, what does it mean to strike not against a specific workplace, even against the entire set of workplaces? That's the way the general strike had conventionally been conceived, but rather in a social frame. What does it mean to strike in that sense? And I think that's a really important organizational question. It could also flow from our earlier part of the conversation, insofar that, you know, part of the hypothesis that Tony and I have when reading contemporary forms of capital, insofar as capitalist production is today primarily social production, that involves a certain amount of analysis, but insofar as production is primarily social production, then the strike must become a social strike. It must be a strike not simply against workplaces, not even simply against capital, but on a social scale, or on capital insofar as it exists on a social scale. That's where, that, at least that's where I would orient a discussion around strike and do it through what the Argentinian feminists are doing.
Michael Hart, he teaches at Duke University. His and Antonio Negri's new book is Assembly. Michael, thank you for your work and thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
And that interview first aired on May 2nd of this year. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.